Game night is the best night, and we're not talking rummy, canasta, or baccarat. All your games in one place. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here for the next 4 hours of what we hope is your listening pleasure. Josh, I think we're filling the quota for you and I doing a show together once a month. And here we are towards the end of November. Once a month, we're doing a show together.
Did we do? I assume we did one in October. I can't really remember. I think maybe early on in October, if I had to guess. Like, it's been like the obviously. I'm trying to think. Like, the NFL season had been going on. This is probably the third show we've done since the season started.
I'm excited. It's a busy program. We'll get to that in a sec. I just want to get your thoughts real quick. Premier Ford announced today that Toronto and Peel is going to get locked down completely again, back to what we saw in the springtime. Everything else is closing and for a minimum of 4 weeks. What was your initial reaction to that news today that it's officially starting midnight on Monday?
I don't want to get, you know, too political or on too much of a soapbox here. Like, I think it's the right move considering where things are going. But it just for some of the things really make that much sense for me. Like, small businesses are closed, but big box stores are still open up to 50%. Like, where do you draw the line? And you're telling people to support small businesses, but you're keeping big businesses open and you're closing small businesses. And I think schools should stay open because that's a whole other, you know, kettle of fish. But it's just I don't really see how crippling small businesses is necessarily going to be the answer here. We'll see what happens in 4 weeks. But some of these people who have put their life into these businesses, you know, like maybe they barely survived the first time around. You're telling me this happens a second time. You can't assume that you're going to come out the other side. And I just don't really know what the end game is here. I guess to really withstand the burden on the hospitals and whatnot, which is obviously important, but you're not going to get down to zero cases. And I don't know, like there's no real easy answer, but I look at what happened today in Toronto and Peel, and I'm not just thinking, well, you know, 4, 5, 6, whatever, however many weeks it is when things maybe are different, like how much better is it going to be and how quickly are we just going to go back to the same problems? It's just like if people don't really take it seriously and are gathering amongst themselves and, you know, not trying to be cautious, then closing businesses isn't really going to be the difference maker.
Right. And you know me, I'm not Mr. Political Guy. I'm not left. I'm not right. I like facts and I like to be in the middle. And when I heard of the lockdown, I immediately thought about the people who struggled the first time around. The people with mental health issues, the people with addiction issues to alcohol and drugs. We know all of those things skyrocketed during the first lockdown. We know domestic abuse went up substantially during the lockdown as well. I feel for those people who have to endure this again. When you're right, Josh, when this first happened and we had a lockdown, I think it was the right move because we didn't know what this was, right? Yeah. We weren't sure. We didn't have too much information. We have to try to get this thing under control. But to go to another full, complete lockdown when, if you just look at the statistics, Josh, the mortality rate is so, so low. And I'm not glossing over the fact that people who have lost family members or anybody who has underlying health issues, I understand all of that. But just statistically, like, it is so low to put all those other people in jeopardy, small business owners, people with these mental health and addiction issues. It's a can't-win situation, but I just feel like it's too extreme for Toronto. And what I worry about being down here in the Niagara region, where we're continually going to be in orange, whatever orange means, life really hasn't changed that much for us down here, but I worry now people from the GTA are going to be migrating down here, going to restaurants, going to bars, eating out because they know it's open down here.
Yeah, I would expect that that, at least in some capacity, is going to happen. I guess, well, is stuff in Niagara, can you be inside in like a reduced yes. capacity or 50% yeah. or something?
Yes,
okay,
sir.
So, yeah, people will go.
And again, I'm not, I haven't been going to bars. I like to work out. I haven't been going to the gym. I've been working out outside when the weather was nice. But it's just not, it's just common sense, right? People want to go to the gyms, fine. You need to support the gyms as well. And I get all of that. Or businesses and get some takeout. But I'm not the guy who's going to be out at a bar and sitting around people who aren't, you know, in a closed area. I just don't want to be in that situation. I think this is a little too extreme for everyone in Toronto. And I feel for you guys up there because 4 weeks of this, when you're right, like what's the end game here?
Do you think I don't know. Yeah.
The win. So in December, right around New Year's. Okay. So you guys are back to orange. And guess what? It's New Year's Eve. People aren't going to gather for New Year's Eve.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you're going to have another explosion of cases. I just don't know what the end game is here. But what I do know is you hear all those positive things about the vaccine, 95% effective. Moderna and Pfizer have these vaccines that Ontario is going to start distributing in July and January to March. And obviously all the people who need it first, the elderly, our front care healthcare workers, people with underlying healthcare issues, they should all be first in line to get the vaccine. It's on the horizon. I just don't understand the extreme measure of closing things. All right, that's it for being political. Staying on the political side of things, the Raptors aren't playing games here in Toronto. And honestly, Josh, I think it's ridiculous. There's rapid tests. The government is testing rapid tests at the Calgary airport so you can fly around the country and be COVID-free. These leagues spent, the NBA and the NHL, spent hundreds of millions of dollars having those two bubbles in Orlando, Edmonton, and Toronto. Three bubbles, excuse me, to just limit COVID-19. We can't pay, those leagues can't pay for rapid tests for these guys to come over, play their game, stay isolated in a hotel, go to the arena, and then leave. We can't do that here? That's not possible? They're going to spread the virus? I don't get that.
No, that's fair, and I guess it basically, and you could say that's a lot about government in the way that, you know, sometimes they, I guess, tailor certain things or they operate. It's a matter of optics, right? And not always, but you're always right. Mindful of how the optics seem. And I guess, you know, for every person who wouldn't have had a big deal with it, there were probably plenty of people who would have said, you know what, the border is closed to, I guess, average Joes, why are athletes getting this special dispensation to cross the border back and forth? Even with that access to testing, like you said, if that would become a thing, which obviously, you know, money is no object, you would have thought. So that would have been. But instead, I guess what the cost is uprooting the Raptors and their family for at least until March, because it said through the at least until the All-Star break, which is early on in March, and that's definitely costly for these players who, you know, have their roots, for the ones that have been here for a while, like they have their homes. But I guess, you know, the cost is, well, it's easier to set up shop temporarily the same way the Jays did in Buffalo rather than just risk upsetting a lot of people and getting, you know, this blowback of bad publicity. And I guess that's probably as much as anything what maybe motivates the government's decision to just say, you know, it's not worth it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't get it. And the whole border close thing, a friend of mine, not going to mention his name, works at the Canadian-U.S. border here in Niagara. And he goes, people are going over to see friends and family. They're allowed to go over to see them.
From the States.
From Canada to the States.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We can go.
Yeah, so that's fine. Oh, so, okay, so they're allowed to go, but they're coming back home here.
Yeah.
After being
yeah.
in America.
Yeah.
That's fine. But our NBA team, who you can give rapid tests to and isolate, can't play.
It's true. That's true.
Yeah. I'm not saying deny. I am absolutely not saying don't go see your friends and family right over the border. But we let that happen here. Like, I don't think a lot of people realize that's going on. And I was surprised when he told me that. He's a border agent here in Niagara, in the Niagara region. He goes, people are going over all the time. And they get grilled on the way back. but they still go.
Like so, grilled, like where were you? Who did, like, did you come into contact or what did you do?
Yeah, stuff like that. But what, that's not an exact science either, right? No. It's not like they're getting tested at the border when they're coming back in.
No, definitely not. Could easily
But we can't have an NBA team come in that we can actually test and monitor to make sure they've been isolated before they play the game against the Raptors.
Yeah. You're making a lot of good points here, George. Like, I guess it's not.
I'm tired of optics, Josh. I'm tired of optics. It's just statistics, right? It's just statistics. Yeah. Like, I'm not minimizing the virus. I am not. It's a very serious thing. I don't want to get it. You don't want to get it.
No.
I don't want my mom to get it, who's 69 years old. I just don't want that to happen. But I'm just saying, like, the way we are doing things, like, you think going back to March in Toronto for 4 weeks is going to slow everything down when you don't have a vaccine, which is on the horizon, which is great, but then we're right around the holiday season? Like, I just don't get it. I don't get it. And I don't get that you can actually – rapid tests exist. They are here. Rapid tests exist. Like, even if you have – if the Raptors a divisional opponent, why don't you bring them in to the city for 2 days at a time, two games? You play back-to-back, and then they're done here in Toronto. They have a rapid test. They're isolated for the 3-4 days they're here, and then they go, and they don't come back. We can't do that?
Yeah,
and we're worried about the optics when people in the Niagara region are hopping over the border to go see Uncle Steve in Chautauqua County.
Well, I'm trying to look at –
But that's
at
okay.
I'm trying, like, to look at how many cases. There were more than 9,000 new cases in Florida today. So, and in Ontario, there were 1,400 or so today. You're probably at a greater risk of getting it in Florida than you are here in Ontario, right? I think,
yes,
like, per capita, you're at greater risk.
I'm not saying these NBA players are going to go to the clubs and super spreader everybody. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the government literally has a test project at the Calgary airport for rapid tests so you can fly around the country. So we can get the airline airline industry back online here and get people to start using air travel again.
Yeah.
But we can't have the Milwaukee Bucks come in for back-to-back games against the Raptors. And the Raptors can't play their home games here.
Yeah, like, I guess, well, like, I'm curious how the schedule is going to work.
And
you
it's
know,
just optics. How... You're right. It's just optics. That's all it is. It's optics.
Yeah.
Because,
like,
to me, it makes no sense.
I am curious how the schedule is going to work, though.
Oh,
for
so
sure.
Toronto, like, FC. Toronto FC was allowed to play home games here against the other Canadian teams. And then, okay, you got to get the hell out of the country and I'll go play in the United States the rest of the time. Like, Toronto FC was allowed to do it.
Connecticut? No, they have. Yeah. I know they were for a while.
Yeah, and the Montreal Impact are playing a playoff game right now, playing game in Eastern Conference. I know you're on pins and needles watching New England and Montreal play right now. But I actually like betting on the Major League Soccer. Anyway, I lost my train of thought. Toronto FC had to do it, which is fine, right? And I know they played within Canada, but, like, what? So we're going to have an all-Canadian division in the NHL. That'll be fine. Like, that'll be okay for everyone, yet we still have cases here. And these guys are traveling from city to city. So Montreal, Quebec has kind of been the epicenter of all of this since it started. So the Habs are okay to come in Toronto where there's more cases. But if the Raptors play the Bucks or somewhere where there isn't, or the Pacers where cases aren't as many as there are in Florida, that's not okay.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, the number, the proof is in the numbers. More cases in, well, I got to check Tampa Bay because we had in and around 400 today in Toronto. And how many did we have in Tampa Bay?
Nobody's defending what's going on in the United States, Josh. They need to get a hold of what's going on with the coronavirus. But good thing with their government. They put in that Operation Warp Speed and got this. I know everybody rips on Trump, but that's the program they put in March, in May, to put billions of dollars to these pharmaceutical companies to come with the vaccine, and they did. We're on the precipice of having the vaccine. Say what you will about the American government, at least they got that right. And you can say, oh, the coronavirus is out of control, blah, 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 blah. It's always revisionist history to me when everything is with the coronavirus. We should have shut our borders, Josh, in December, not in March. But why didn't we? Because we were so worried. Oh, no, you're being too xenophobic. You can't do it. We can't do it. You're being racist. We can't shut our borders down. We should have to America and everybody. We would have been completely fine by now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's all about optics. It's all about optics. Yeah. And you nailed it on. You just nailed it. There is no way NBA teams can play in Canada. The technology is there. How do guys in the NFL, Josh, test positive or in contact somebody with coronavirus on Monday and are allowed to play Sunday? Hell, Wednesday, they're in contact with somebody, they get multiple tests, and they're clear to play Sunday. How is that possible?
Because they have, you know, like you said, they have the resources. They test, right, and they implement their you know, whatever they call it, their intensive protocols, and it seems like it's worked. Like I gotta say, I wasn't when the NFL got off to the start they got off to. I was optimistic. Then I was pessimistic. Now you know what I see: guys get cases, and the hope is obviously it's no big deal. You know, they'll just be able to brush it off and not have any issues. And so far, it doesn't seem like anyone has. But yeah, their protocols do seem to be working. And if you had asked most people, would we be basically on track into, I guess, week 11 of the season? If you had asked this question to people 6-7 weeks ago, most people would have said no, and they have, and it's a testament to their ability to test and trace and shut things down around certain teams if they need to and adjust on the fly. And you would think that other leagues would be able to do that too. I would hope, and I would certainly think.
Yeah. And what did the latest study come out from the NFL? That these guys are testing positive, not from within their team, Josh, but community spread, which feels counterintuitive, but it's fact. Guys who are getting the coronavirus in the NFL are getting it from outside of the team. The team doesn't spread it from within because of the protocols they have. So Yeah, sorry, a 53-man roster of guys who are side-by-side playing a contact sport aren't spreading it to one another, when in the NBA, you're close contact and it's indoors, and I get all of that, but you can't isolate 13 guys on an NBA roster and come here to play in Canada? I don't get it.
What? It kind of comes a little bit full circle, and you're talking about the NFL and how they're getting it in the community and not within their I guess, facility games. Same way here, you're not seeing – I don't think there's been proven to be a lot of transmission in stores, in businesses, grocery stores, retail, whatever it is. The majority of the spread is close contact for prolonged periods of time in somebody's home, in an indoor setting, like a something like that, usually at somebody's home. Even restaurants, bars, like to a lesser extent, are still not great, but private gatherings at home. You know, if you're in a store for a short period of time, how many people are spending hours and hours in a store? Like, you're going to do your business in 20 to 30 minutes and at most and get out. And it's just that, to me, doesn't seem like the most, we're bringing it back here, productive way about going about this. And you could say the same thing in a respect about some of the ways that these leagues are going about it.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating, and it sucks for the Raptors, who are going to have to live out of their suitcase for the first few months of the season, just based on what you said, optics. Donovan Bennett, digital host for Sportsnet, will join us at 7:25. Apparently, Fred VanVleet's going to meet with the Raptors tomorrow in Chicago. Adrian Wojnarowski saying that it looks like he might be staying in Toronto, which is great news. We'll talk to DJ about the Raptors and free agency and what's going to happen with Serge Ibaka. Later on this hour as well, Josh, the five places where beer hits just different than normal. Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report, will look around week 11 of the NFL. And just shocking news today from New Orleans. I don't know, I was shocked. Taysom Hill, not famous Jameis Winston getting the start for the Saints against the Falcons at home on Sunday. And I guess Sean Payton's a man of his word. He loves him some Taysom Hill. They didn't want to lose him at all, so now Taysom Hill gets his chance to start a quarterback on Sunday. Jonathan Davis, host on SiriusXM NHL Radio. We'll look around the league. Issues with deferred payments and escrow, and when is the league potentially going to start? We'll touch with that with Jonathan Davis. Ryan M. Spader, co-host of the Walk Off podcast, author of the Incredible Baseball Stats, the coolest, strangest stats and facts in baseball history. We'll look around Major League Baseball. It's free agency's going on. It's just we all anticipated it moving at a snail's pace. And are you ready to play some Dragon's Breath later on in the show?
Yeah, always, George. And I've been prepping. You prepared show, and I was producing the show tonight with the takes, and I'm trying to wrap my head around the position I'm gonna take.
I don't know what you're talking about, because the Fan 590 Dragon Fanny spits them out. I have no idea what she's gonna give out. So
somebody was asking me this. So is Fanny a boy or a female or a male?
Is it a female
Fanny. Dragon?
Okay, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. The Fan Twitter account referred to Fanny as a male, and I wanted to correct the tweet, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Yeah, Fanny does. She does a terrific job of watching sports and loves firing out just ridiculously hot takes. All right, it's Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh for the only time this month. Straight ahead, Donovan Bennett, digital host for Sportsnet. I apologize for all of you who had to listen to us get on our soapbox about the Raptors and not playing here, but that's just the way I feel. And good luck to all of you in Toronto and in Peel region who have to now endure being locked down for the next 4 weeks. All right, DJ on the Raptors, straight ahead. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here till 11 p.m. at the top of the clock. Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report. We'll talk about Taysom Hill getting the start for the injured Drew Brees as the Saints take on the Falcons in Week 11. But NBA free agency has kicked off. We're waiting to hear where Fred VanVleet is going to end up, where Serge Ibaka is potentially going to end up as well, to talk about that. Digital host for Sportsnet, always fun to talk to our pal DJ Donovan Bennett. Donovan, how are you?
Good, fellas. How are you?
We're good. We're excited. When you saw the tweet from Woj that it looks like Fred VanVleet is leaning towards staying in Toronto, what was your initial reaction?
Not overly surprised, to be honest. I mean, like, it's a game of musical chairs, and you know, there were certainly some Fred VanVleet suitors, but you just look around and there are less and less . We knew coming in this was a draft class full of point guards, and you know, the Magic took one in Cole Anthony, and then you know, now took another in an undrafted Kareem Manning, the Canadian. You know, the Pistons drafted Killian Hayes, someone who, you know, athletically is one of the best players in the draft. The Suns did it via free agency with Chris Paul. You know, so you're just running out of literal spots to place a Fred VanVleet, and we knew he was going to want two things. Anyone who was surprised to hear him say that he wanted to cash out really hasn't been paying attention. His slogan is bet on yourself, and the logo, the B-O-Y, like the O is a money bag. Like, of course he's going to want to cash out at this point, but also like role responsibility and team fit was going to be important. And that's certainly something that the Raptors could offer. They could tell him exactly how much he's valued because he was a starter, for one, and two, like, he was an easy succession plan after Kyle Lowry. So I'm not overly surprised, one, that he was going to go through the process and wanted some recruitment as an undrafted guy and a guy who went to a smaller college in the NCAA. Having that experience is a real thing, even if it means it's like Zoom calls and not, you know, jets flying in like it was for big free agents in past years. But two, I wasn't surprised to hear that the Raptors would be where he's leaning because they can offer the two things he wants the most.
So coming into this offseason, it felt like, you know, the Raptors could go with Van Vliet on a four-year deal and not really sacrifice their flexibility for next offseason and beyond. And, you know, you looked at Ibaka and Gasol, and maybe they could be back on one-year deals. But, you know, now with – assuming Van Vliet is brought back like we're talking about – what do you think happens with Serge? Because I saw Michael Grange say maybe double-digit teams have interest in him on a multi-year deal, some for more than the mid-level. Do you think that the Raptors will get in there on maybe a three-year deal for double-digit million per season? Or do you think that anything beyond one or perhaps a one-year with an option will be too much for them to sacrifice that flexibility going forward?
I think so. I don't think you want to necessarily tie money up for that long. I mean, they really, their books are pretty clean right now. Obviously, Lowry with the $30 million next year. You know, the 25 and 23 respectively that Mark Gasol and Serge Ibaka get come off the books. Theoretically, Serge isn't going to make that much. So you're going to have some savings at your center position, no matter who's there. And then really next year, you know, without the Norm deal, you got Pascal. You know, we have a player option for Norman Powell, which, you know, we'd assume take at $11.5 million. And that's pretty much it, right? Matt Thomas is just under two. Dejuan Hernandez is just under two. So you want to keep that flexibility in 21, 22 when Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, potentially LeBron James, but obviously Giannis, all are going to be on the market. And so that's why I wouldn't want to go long term with Serge, but it's going to be a question of, well, what does Serge want at this point of his career? Does he want to continue to compete for championships? Does he want to make sure that the brand of Mufuzi Chef is strong? And that's why maybe taking less money to play in LA makes sense, because that would dovetail into, you know, a future career where he could be, you know, the Michael Strahan of basketball. The Brooklyn Nets, certainly being in the Metroplex of New York, would offer that. And Kevin Durant's brother has already tweeted that Serge, you know, would be heading to Brooklyn. And obviously, KD and Serge have a relationship from their days in OKC. Or do you just want to cash out and go to teams that really are not going to be winning anytime soon, but could offer him a big role, and he could be a mentor for the young players, and he can make a lot of money. And then Toronto's the option where, depending on where the money is, you could get a little bit of a bunch of those things. And so I think, again, it's the motivation of the player. But I'm not surprised that Serge Ibaka now, a couple of years later, has more suitors than he did when the Raptors re-signed him, because the game has continued to change. Where is he a four? Is he a five? No, he's clearly a five that allows you to play five out. His defensive metrics haven't fallen off the cliff, which you expect for a center of his age. So, yeah, I'm not surprised. And he's got that championship shine as well. So he's the interesting one. I was always pretty sure that, and we'll still see, that Fred would get done and would stay in Toronto. Serge was the other one who I wasn't so sure, because I'm not sure it makes the most sense for the club, and I'm not sure it makes the most sense for the player.
Donovan, if and when Fred does re-sign, is that a window into what the Raptors will do next year, you think, just based on being a more competitive team? Because if Fred Van Vliet walks, then Masai and Bobby Webster have a ton of stuff to do. But if Fred stays, do you think that's an indication that they think they'll be serious about signing a free agent next year?
I think so. And I do think that, like, the financial ramifications are going to play into all of this. Like, you guys know better than anyone, like, sports teams are a for-profit business. And yes, owners love to win, and they love the ego of having a suite with their friends. But they also, they don't want to lose at the end of the day. And the uncertainty, certainly, in terms of what teams are going to be able to have fans in the stands, or what the basketball-related income is going to be for the entire league, is a real thing. And remember, we learned today that the Raptors, for the foreseeable future, not only are they not going to have fans in their stands, they're not going to have themselves in their own arena. So I do think finances matter, where the Raptors might be able to absorb some financial pain points in the short term and offer someone like Fred more money in the year of 2020, 2021. And then that salary, instead of ascending like it normally does with the cap, potentially dips in the year of 21-22 to absorb more salary in terms of free agents. Then if Fred is smart, he just cares about, at the end of the day, what's my guaranteed money for the lifetime of the contract. So as long as my average per year is close to a Malcolm Brogdon, for example, I think you'd be okay. But I think this is really where Bobby Webster earns his money and does some cap gymnastics to make sure that, again, when their powder is dry in 21-22, they can be really aggressive for sustained success for the next 3, 4, 5 years. But I think the biggest question is, how long is Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster going to be around to make those decisions? Those are the free agents that Raptors fans should be nervous about, more so than what Fred VanVleet is going to do, or what Serge Ibaka is going to do, or what continent Marc Gasol is going to play on.
Donovan, how much do the Raptors want to jump in the luxury tax?
I mean, want is an interesting word. I don't think they want to. In the history of the franchise, is that they really haven't. But I do think, and again, I think it's tied to those two names. Like, if you want to keep those guys around, you have to show that you're competitive. And look at the tax bill that Bob Myers is getting to spend of Joe Lacob's money right now. It's really a full salary cap in luxury tax payments. So I think the Raptors certainly will have to get into the tax if they want to keep up with the Joneses in the East, with Brooklyn and Philly and Boston all being really competitive and making major moves. So I don't really think they're going to have a choice if they want to continue to stay competitive.
So I still am kind of racking my brain as to what a successful offseason will be for the Raps. I guess you re-sign VanVleet. Maybe, as Granger's saying, you re-sign OG on a reasonable deal. You bet on the upside that he has another level to get to. Your other guys, you know, Ibaka, Gasol, are maybe a little bit less important. But is it not a successful offseason for you if you don't re-sign Ujiri and Webster, and they're your, I guess, brain trust for the next 4, 5, 6, whatever years?
Yeah, that's the biggest question hanging over the entire organization is what happens with those two guys. And they are intrinsically linked, right? When Masai came to Toronto, he had some, I don't want to say demands because that sounds pretty aggressive, but he had some things that he wanted to be able to do. And one of them was to get Bobby Webster and Teresa Rush from the league office. And, you know, we've seen that team stay together. And so I just don't know really at this point. Like, I'm not really sure how this wasn't done, like, before Masai jumped in the Ford convertible and went down Bay Street. Like, what else did you need to see at that point? So the fact that this is dragged on to this point, to me, is not a good sign. But whether it is, more flexibility in terms of what he spends, whether it's ownership stake, whether it's a higher title, whatever it is, like, there are 1,000 ownership groups that would love a Masai Ujiri or Bobby Webster's. There's only one of them, to steal a line from Kanye West when I used to listen to his music. Like, the leverage is all on one side. So the fact that it hasn't happened, to me, if you are MLSC, just look at your history. Do you have a track record of success without those two guys in your front office? The answer is no. So unless you have a succession plan where you can sustain success, where all those corporate sponsors are continued to be happy, where that building is still full, where your TV partners and Bell and Rogers continue to get ratings that increase year over year over year, unless you have a succession plan that allows you to continue that, there's literally no price that would be too much for you to resign those two guys, because we know, like, the sport is ascending in our country. So many advertisers and marketers want to be tied to it, but they only want to be tied to it if the team is winning. And if that goes, forget about the numbers in the wins and loss column. The numbers in the bank books certainly will change drastically. So, again, to me, it's head scratching, concerning, whatever term you want to use. Those are the two. That's the push alert that I want to see, is that those guys have signed a contract, because they've shown that they can find another Fred VanVleet or another Serge Ibaka, or they can put the chips in the middle of the table and make a move for someone like Kawhi Leonard. Like, they've been able to unearth talent time after time after time. So you got to lock them up.
Do you think that they're a package deal? Like, do you think if Masai leaves for, I don't know, just a bigger gig, like whether it's with the NBA or something altogether different, that Bobby Webster will stay and maybe just kind of get a promotion? Or do you think that they're kind of intrinsically linked, and if one goes, they both go?
I mean, I think for Bobby, it's probably a package deal. I mean, he's obviously been in the running for jobs in the past. He was, you know, one of the finalists on the short list for the Chicago Bulls job and didn't get it. So, I mean, certainly for someone who, you know, has visions of running their own team with no real president above them, he certainly wants to know, if I'm going to be here and run this team, I want to respect and understand the relationship with the person above me, and clearly that's the case with Masai. He doesn't want an Alex Anthopoulos type of scenario where he's the GM, but there's, you know, a basketball mind above him. But for Masai, I think, like, we've seen it, that he, no matter what his situation, he's worked to take care of his guys. He's done a deal for Nick Nurse, even though his deal is not taken care of. He's taken care of Nick Nurse's assistants, even though his deal is not taken care of. So he's used this period to make sure that his team and his squad is good, Bobby Webster, you know, notwithstanding. So I think it's more of a package deal for Bobby, theoretically, making sure that he understands exactly what he's signing up for than it would be for Masai.
Donovan Bennett's a digital host for Sportsnet, joining us here on Sportsnet Tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet radio network. All right, Donovan, let's live in this world where Serge and Fred re-sign with the Raptors. Where is Toronto, in your mind, in the Eastern Conference? We know the Celtics are very talented. They knocked the Raptors out. The Heat got to the NBA Finals. The Bucks have beefed up their roster. The Heat got the Heat's terrific. The Brooklyn Nets are going to have Durant and Kyrie and probably James Harden too. Where do the Raptors slot in all of this?
So last year, not at this time because this year was the season, but this time relative to the start of the season, I said, you know what, championship pedigree, brought the band back, didn't make a big splash like some other teams. You know, I see them around third, fourth. And, you know, we, the North Nation, just crushed me for it, as if that's disrespectful. And you know, made sure to screen cap it and show it to me every day that, you know, they were in first place. And so I don't want to make that mistake, because one of the things that you can't really gauge at this point is, like, internal growth. Like, part of the reason why they've had sustained success and slowly got better, because their players got better, that they really invest in player development more so than the only way we can get better as a franchise is through the draft or through free agency. But we can actually work with our talent. The question is just, like, how much of this talent is going to be back? You know, we know Chris Boucher is going to be back, and O'Shea Bissett's going to be back. But, you know, is Rondé going to be back? Maybe, maybe not. Stanley Johnson has opted in. There's obviously Fred a question mark, Serge a question mark, Mark Gasol a question mark. So it's a big portion of your core that is still a massive question mark. So as of we sit here today on Friday, November 20th, not knowing what happens and not knowing, again, as they bargain shop for no-name brand players on one-plus-one deals to keep their money free in 2021-22, it's tough for me to say that they're going to challenge for the top of the East, which is not disrespectful because I think the East is getting better. The Nets certainly are better. The Miami Heat's probably going to be closer to the team in the bubble than they were for the regular season. I think with some closer to competent coaching and a, you know, an aggressive GM, the Sixers are already better, and we'll see, you know, as Morey continues to tweak. So, you know, fourth, fifth, in and around, competing, you know, for home court in the first round, I think is a realistic you know, expectation on what you should see from the Raptors. Now, again, this is going to get aggregated and people are going to crush me for saying that. But as of today, I just think, like, the housing market in the East and in the Atlantic specifically has gone up. And so outside of the Raptors, you know, doing some interior decorating and renovating their kitchen, like, I just don't know how much we can expect them to have another year where they set the bar so high and increase their franchise best in terms of winning percentage.
I think that's totally fair. And it just, like, realistically, there's just not that many avenues to huge improvement and moving the ceiling. I guess maybe OG taking another step forward would maybe change the conversation. He had a really good season, had a really solid playoffs. Definitely seems like there is another level there. I wasn't expecting, you know, an extension heading into the season, but what do you make of that? And do you think, you know, it's the right time to really, you know, kind of reward him and maybe buy up some years where he could vastly outperform whatever number he could be making?
For sure. I mean, when we go, you know, 2 years ago, we looked at the franchise, it was a debate. Who's the player that's going to take that huge leap, Pascal and OG? And obviously, it was Pascal, and he's continued to improve. But there's no reason, from an age profile standpoint, where OG can't take a similar leap this year as to the one we saw Pascal take last year and even the year before. I mean, just look at his age profile. He's 23. He feels like he's somewhat of a veteran on the team. He's like just the second youngest guy on the team. O'Shea Brissett's 22, outside of obviously the two draft picks who are 22, a year younger than OG. But yeah, he's the person that's going to take the step again because of his age. Terrence Davis, 23, may or may not be on the team, may or may not be a free citizen by the time the season is over. Norman Powell is kind of what he is. He's 27 at this point. You just hope he's a little bit more consistent in his performances. But in terms of taking another step, you know, Fred with maybe an increase in minutes potentially and comfort with that financial security. But yeah, when we look at this team in terms of that internal improvement that I was speaking of, it's coming from OG potentially. Chris Boucher could improve again with a bigger role. He's 27 years old. Like, at some point, you kind of are what you are. OG, and we saw him hit that three consistently in the restart. If he continues to do that and maybe even adds, you know, a three off the dribble, we're talking about a player who's a nice role player to a player who, you know, athletically is more than just a 3-and-D guy. He's a real force on the wing.
DJ, before I let you go, you have a great piece at sportsnet.ca about Kareem Mané. You want to fill us in on that?
Yeah, so this is a kid, and it's a Canadian story. You know, family comes here, immigrants from Senegal, you know, settles in the South Shore of Montreal, picks up the sport about 5 years ago, and he now rapidly is improved and has gone from the CJEP high school or post-secondary system of basketball in Montreal directly to the NBA. He had massive NCAA offers in Marquette, in Memphis, in Georgetown, Michigan State. But with the uncertainty of what college basketball may or may not be because of COVID-19, and the fact that he already had NBA interest, he just decided he's going to take the leap because he's so young in his development that he needs constant work. He needs to continue to progress. So it's just an amazing story, you know, that Canada basketball in unlikely ways is continuing to present, you know, prospects. Nate Darling from Nova Scotia, not the place where you thought you'd see an NBA player a couple years ago. He signed a deal, you know, with Charlotte. Manny signed a deal with the Orlando Magic. And yes, the streak at 9 years was broken this year when we didn't have a Canadian drafted, but the cupboard isn't bare. In the next two drafts, we're expecting, you know, around four Canadians to be picked. And by 2023-24, you know, the projections are looking like you could have anywhere from 40 to 50 Canadians playing in the NBA. That, to me, is not something that I would think I would see in my lifetime, like four or five full teams, full rosters of Canadians playing in the NBA. But they're coming from all over the place now, not just the GTA. And Kareem Mané is a great example of that.
And real quick, John from Waterloo sent us a text. Let Mr. Bennett know that the Mongolian Grill in Waterloo is closing for good. What does that mean to you?
I heard that, and it's devastating. It's a place that you crush in university, whether it was London, Ontario, Waterloo, the Mongolian Grill. Use your student card there. Give me the extra sauce and the extra meat. Such a good look, especially if you're like me, balling on a budget. So, yeah, we will be pouring a sip out for the Mongolian Grills that are closed and all the restaurants, quite frankly, that are closing due to more COVID-19 lockdowns. Not a great story. And actually, shout out to all of the support workers, and you guys have gone down to the stadium and you've dealt with them that really keep Raptors basketball alive at Scotiabank Arena. No games there for a while means a lot of people won't be getting paychecks. So, it's probably a smart health decision, but a sad day today.
Yeah, well said. Donovan Bennett's a digital host for Sportsnet. DJ, always fun. Thanks for this.
No worries.
There he goes, Donovan Bennett. Straight ahead, Josh, and Adrian Wojnarowski saying that a lot of Eastern Conference teams want to lure Serge Ibaka away from the Raptors, but Toronto, of course, strong interest in keeping him too. I got a feeling we might find out about Serge maybe by the end of our show. What do you think?
Let's hope so. It's been kind of slow so far. Like, there have been moves, certainly, but nothing, you know, too noteworthy. Let's get something cooking, whether it's Van Vliet, OG extension, Serge, something Raptors related to really give us that boost of content.
Before we break, or after the break, the five places where beers hit different than normal. But first, Black Friday is on now at your Chevrolet dealer. Right now, for a limited time only, get great offers across the lineup, plus a $500 Black Friday bonus on most models. But hurry, this offer ends November 30th. Straight ahead, beers and Brett Sobleski on the NFL. Straight ahead, Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here till 11 p.m. at the top of the clock. Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report, will join us. Taysom Hill getting the start Sunday for the Saints against the Falcons. I don't know how Saints head coach Sean Payton is going to be able to sleep with all the excitement of finally having Taysom Hill as his starting quarterback. And Jonathan Davis, host on Sirius XM NHL Radio, will talk about a potential start and when he thinks the season will potentially start in the NHL. But first, saw this on Twitter. Josh, want to get your thoughts here. Again, this isn't a, you know, go out and just drink your face off. But there was a blog on the Bro Bible website about top five places to have a beer, where beer just hits different. It just tastes better in these five specific spots. All right, here's their list. Number five, movie theater beers. Have you ever had a beer at a movie theater?
Yes, I have.
It's awesome.
It is good. Yeah, it is good. Yeah. It goes nicely with the salty popcorn, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's different. It's awesome. Okay. I've done this too, and I enjoy it, especially before going out. Shower beers. You ever had a shower beer?
Never done it. The heat. I've done a hot tub beer. It makes me a little bit lightheaded.
Okay, I enjoy the shower beer. Number three, no brainer too. Golf course beers.
100%, good one.
Like slam dunk. And this, you know, this is an American a blog when number two is bowling alley beers.
I'm trying to, like, what would the comp be?
Hockey, like, for sure. Dressing room beer.
Yeah, for sure. And that's a rite of passage, right? You play beer league. Oh, generally speaking, it's somebody buys the beer every week and you have one or a couple in the room after the game.
And number one, which was surprising to me, but when you think about it, it makes sense. Airport beer. You're waiting for your flight. You're at the bar. You're having a beer. An airport beer tastes different than a regular beer.
So I've done it. It has to be in the right situation. If it's like a hectic trip, like a in and out type of thing, maybe not. But like if I'm heading somewhere nice, like on a leisure vacation, and everything's smooth sailing and you're good to go and you're gonna be gone for a while, yeah, give me a couple, like maybe I'll get blasted before I get on the plane, like that's totally fine. But it's like you have to be a good flyer, or maybe if you're a bad flyer you toast a couple and, you know, maybe you're not as anxious getting onto the plane. I guess there's not really that much downside to having at least one before you get on a plane.
We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us a text, 590-590, name and location. Top three places where a beer just hits different, tastes different. We'd love to hear from you. Name and location, please. We'll read those throughout the show. Top three places where a beer just hits different. Real quick, my top three, I think golf course number one, Josh, dressing room number two, and shower number three for me.
So, okay, golf course is number two for me. Number one is sporting event. I know it's expensive, but ooh, baby, like crisp. Those crisp suds in a draft, always. Like, I always want draft in that situation. Hits just so smooth. I love it. Whether it's a hot, bacon hot day at the dome with the roof open where those plastic seats are just heating up your ass as you're sitting there just melting away for 4 hours. Doesn't matter. I love it. So that would be number one. And then number two, golf course. And then number three. I'm trying to think. I guess just like patio, backyard, like have grilling with some friends, something like that. It's just like, you know, what completes it? Beer. Whether it's like restaurant patio, I feel like, you know, it's expected. Just like you're out in your backyard, you know, with friends, loved ones, whatever. Beer just hits really nice every time.
Yeah, Jay, real quick from Brantford, a ball game in the heat of summer is a great place to have a beer.
Yeah, there you go, Jay. More.
Nothing beats shelling out $12 for a tall boy at Rogers. Is it 12 or 14? I can't remember.
I think, after you have like two or three,
yeah, you don't even care after you have whatever. Just bring another cold beer my way. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us a text, 590, 590. Top three places. A beer just tastes different to you. Shoot us a text, name and location. We'll read those throughout the program. Straight ahead, Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report. We'll look around week 11 in the NHL and talk some pucks with Jonathan Davis, host on Sirius XM NHL Radio. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network.
When the sun goes down, we up the ante. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. 1 hour down. Three to go. George Russick, Josh Goldberg. Later on this hour, Jonathan Davis, host on Sirius XM NHL Radio. And we're taking your texts and some of your tweets at Russick SN590, at JGoldberg12. Top three places a beer just tastes different. This one's good here before we get to Brent. Jeremy from Toronto, I call the airport beer the pre-flight checklist. Best beer. It's not bad.
Yeah, I like that.
It's not bad. George from Ajax, a beer on the patio, adding up the scorecard after golf. Definitely the after-the-game beer in the dressing room, too. Oh, yeah. That delicious, sweet after-the-game beer in the dressing room while you're taking off your gear is fantastic. Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report, joins us. Brent, how are you?
I'm doing well, and you should include it in my title, Beer Snob, because I am definitely one. And my favorite beer place to have a beer is the brewery that I have yet to visit, and I'm trying it for the first time. I love the thrill of going to new places and trying new delicious beverages.
Okay.
Are you an airport beer guy, too? Because we've heard a lot of that.
Well, you know, when you cover the NFL, I work a lot from home on top of it, so I don't get out as much as I used to or fly as much as I used to. I'll tell you the one time, though, that it was the sweetest beer I've ever had. It was after my first ever rugby practice when I was in college, and that stuff went down like water. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, nothing beats after sports, especially rugby, where the culture is. Let's get after it after the game slash the practice. All right, Brent. Week 11's upon us, and we know Drew Brees was placed on IR today. Minimum 3 weeks now he'll be out. And I think a lot of us assume that Jameis Winston was going to be the starting quarterback for the Saints. Nuh-uh. Taysom Hill is going to get the start for New Orleans. Is this really surprising with how much Sean Payton loves him some Taysom Hill?
Do you know why everyone assumed it was going to be Jameis Winston? Because it was the logical move, and yet they didn't go that route. It's ridiculous. When you are in a position a week ago, and you have Drew injured for the first time, this season, which he was last year, and we saw what happened with Teddy Bridgewater coming in, keeping the team afloat, and keeping essentially their season alive as they made a playoff push. They're a very similar situation. And what they did was play Jameis Winston on first and second down and then Taysom Hill on third down. Is that what's the player that's supposed to be your quote-unquote future franchise quarterback? Come on, man. And I understand. I fully get the financials of the NFL and that they gave him a one-year $16 million extension this offseason. With that said, Jameis Winston has far more potential both short-term and long-term at that position than Taysom Hill does. And the fact that they decided to move forward with the alternative just does not make logical sense to me when you're still trying to maintain your status as arguably the best team in the NFC and potential Super Bowl contenders.
What do you think the Saints offense looks like with Taysom Hill at quarterback as a traditional quarterback? Yeah, there I'm sure will be plays with the wildcat and, you know, designed runs and whatnot, but just, you know, three-step drop, five-step drop, can Taysom Hill, we've seen it in spurts, can he throw the ball, you know, 30, 35 times and lead an offense to a win, or do you think that the Falcons are ripe for an upset?
Well, don't get me wrong. Look, I remember watching Taysom at BYU, and he was an exceptional quarterback prospect. But obviously injuries got in the way, and it really hurt his potential for the next level. And we haven't seen him utilized the same way now that he's been in the NFL. And that's really what's disappointing because, you know, at one point he looked like he could be a legitimate prospect. Now, the thing is, though, if you're not utilizing him properly when he is in games, when you're not asking him to throw the ball consistently, which they haven't, it's a telltale sign of what you, of how you actually view him. I get that he's a special person on your team, that he's willing to do anything, a great teammate, and he brings a different dynamic to your offense and even things like special teams. But that does not make a good quarterback. And you want to see him consistently work within the structure of the offense. Yes, you can change some things. You can add little wrinkles and nuances to accentuate his skill set, which any good coaching staff should do. But at the same time, does that now limit what you're capable of? And I believe that's the case.
Brent, how much is that an ego of Sean Payton that I'm going to make this work because I've seen this guy and I know totally what I'm doing with this guy and how to make him a special athlete?
Well, to an extent, we've seen that for a few years now, right? I mean, how many times have we seen Saints offensive series almost grind to a halt because they shoehorn him in to the flow of the play calling when you have Drew Brees? It's not like you're unsettled at the quarterback position. You have one of the all-time greats, the most prolific passer in NFL history, and yet they would still find what we would look at as complimentary packages just to include him. And it's just been consistent with Sean Payton and the Saints. And I fail to grasp why they like him as much as they do. I understand all the things that I mentioned earlier about who he is as a person, but at the same time, you need someone who can help make you consistently win. And if you place him in a position where he's now shouldering the entire offense, I'm not sure he's capable of doing that at the professional level.
I want to look back at the last night's game, Seattle, you know, avenging that loss from a couple of weeks ago with a nice win over Arizona. And the biggest takeaway for me was Seattle's defense looked a lot better, and Carlos Dunlap had the sack to put it away. And, you know, does his presence, I think he's got 3.5 sacks in 4 games, change your perspective on Seattle's candidacy, you know, as a Super Bowl contender? Or do you still think that a lot of the issues that they've seen defensively the first half of the season are going to be too tough to solve come, you know, January, February?
Now, think about that a second, right? You know, the statistic you just mentioned, the stats that the sack production we've seen from Carlos Dunlap since being traded right before the deadline. He has as many sacks as any other Seahawk who's played the entire season for them along the defensive line. That tells you how desperately they needed someone of that ilk playing on the edge and able to get after quarterbacks. Look, we know for the last 2 seasons, the Seattle Seahawks have attempted to rectify their edge presence. They went out and traded for Jadeveon Clowney. Didn't quite work out in their favor. went out and signed Ziggy Ansah. They've drafted guys. They signed guys. They've thrown everything they could against the wall in an attempt to try to manufacture a pass rush. Well, the best way to do so, apparently, is to go out and trade for some other franchise's all-time leading sack artist, which I don't know if a lot of people realize that. Carlos Dunlap is the Bengals' all-time leading sack artist. So you know he knows how to get to the quarterback, and he's shown the capabilities of doing so very quickly. In fact, he had more quarterback pressures last night than the rest of the defense combined. So it shows you that he knows how to do exactly what the Seahawks needed the most within that scheme. But it's not simply going to be him. Yes, that was a huge piece of the puzzle. You added Damon Harrison. You got Jamal Adams healthy. You know, this is a unit that, as long as they don't make the mental mistakes, they don't need to play. They don't need to be the Legion of Boom. They just simply need to be incrementally better than they were to start the season, which was arguably the worst defensive unit we've seen in NFL history. And so when you go and face someone like Kyler Murray, who the previous week, what did we talk about? Or at least the previous 4 days, what did we talk about? MVP candidate. Did he surpass Russell Wilson? Is he going to be the next great dual-threat quarterback because his statistics or actually surpassed Lamar Jackson at the same point last year? And so he had 265 passing or 257 passing yards and 15 rushing yards. That shows a good, disciplined effort from all three levels of the Seahawks defense, which should be enough to get them to a higher level in the NFC because that offense is so potent.
Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet radio network. Are you like me when you watch the Cardinals occasionally, Brent, that you just question Cliff Kingsbury's play calling sometimes? It's just nonsensical at times, and it took them that long to get DeAndre Hopkins involved into the offense until the second half. And I know they were trying to do a good job of shutting him down and doubling him, but they got whatever they wanted with DeAndre Hopkins in the second half. I just don't get what Cliff Kingsbury and the Cardinals are doing.
Well, that's understandable, and that dates back to when Kingsbury was running Texas Tech. I mean, let's be honest. It's not like he was smooth sailing when he was head coach at the Big 12, hence why he was dismissed and then surprisingly become an NFL head coach. But it's been successful, relatively speaking. And a lot of it has to do with having the right pieces in place, Murray being the primary example. And when you don't have certain individuals clicking, then there becomes issues, and it really hangs up all of the sequential play calling. So last night, for example, we gave a lot of credit to Seattle's defense, and deservedly so. At the same time, when you look at the way Murray in particular performed last night, he missed certain throws that you would expect him to make. He had multiple poorly placed tosses along the way as well. Now, I understand his shoulder was bothering him a little bit. He got banged up, and he had to play through it. But that's part of being an NFL quarterback, and if you're not hitting the throws that are there and available to you, it's hard to me to place the entire onus on the play caller when the individual needs to execute. So, yes, there's questionable things in Kingsbury's arsenal. We've seen that dating back to his collegiate days. But at the same time, you still need those, when you place them in a position to succeed, to have those individuals perform and execute when it's available to them.
You know, the Dolphins to me are a team that it's just a real confounding team. They've won five in a row. Tua, you know, has looked better as he's progressed a little bit in his couple of starts. I think they have the sixth or seventh best point differential in the league, like plus 70 almost is really impressive. Are you buying, or are you still in, I guess, fact-finding mode with them, whether they're for real this year and could make some noise as a possible playoff team?
Oh, I'm all in with the Miami Dolphins. So let me give you the reason why. It's more of an irritant than anything else. Do you remember the report that came out, 3 weeks ago about why the Miami Dolphins, at least part of the reason, decided to start Tua at this juncture in the year? It was because, as Adam Schefter reported, that they wanted to make sure that they got a dress rehearsal, as it were, for this season, and if they had a high enough draft pick, that they would be in position to potentially pick a replacement. And I thought that was the most, excuse my language, ass-backwards way to handle roster management that you can possibly do in the NFL. When you invest a top five overall selection in a quarterback, you're all in, or you should be all in, and you should be doing everything in your power to make that individual successful. So that's really what bothered me about how Miami was trending. They're doing a lot of things right. They rebuilt the offensive line. They're young and talented up front. Their defense is top five in the NFL in scoring defense. They have a fantastic secondary. They have guys that are playing up to their free agent contracts, which isn't always the case when you look around the NFL. And I like the way that they play disciplined football. But to me, it comes down to that rookie and how they're setting him up to succeed. I don't like part of the reason why they place him in the starting lineup, but I think they're a better team overall, and he can show and grow into the efficient and electric quarterback we saw at Alabama over time.
Brent, it's a rematch this Sunday in Baltimore of the division round game where the Titans went into Baltimore and upset the Ravens, even though Baltimore had like 600 yards of total offense. Which one of those teams to you has surprised you more with their inconsistent play? Well, obviously the answer's the Ravens, but are the Titans even a contender to you, or their 6-3 record is a bit of a mirage based on that defense, which is a bit of a mirage?
Well, I think a lot of it, we looked at Tennessee, and as a potential regression candidate this year. Because when you saw what they did a year ago, not only defensively they played extremely well, then you lose Logan Ryan and you trade away Jarrell Casey. But simultaneously, you didn't expect Ryan Tannehill and Derrick Henry to be quite as good as we saw a year ago. Now, to start the year, they were excellent. But at the same time, you start losing pieces, as we saw on the defense, as we saw on the offense as well. When you lose your best blocker in Taylor Lewan, that creates a ripple effect throughout the entire offense, not only through your front five, but how your blocking schemes are set up, how you are trying to counter very good defenses and defensive fronts, which the Ravens have. So that's one of the things you see and why a slight regression, at least in recent weeks. Now, the point with Baltimore is very similar, because you have the issues along the offensive line as well. And those were known before the season began. There was an open competition at center. You were losing Marshall Yonder to retirement. You didn't know at that time, but now you do, that you weren't going to have your franchise left tackle for the entirety of the season because of an injury. And you're moving guys, you know, from right to left tackle and so on and so forth. So it makes it very difficult to create any continuity. Furthermore, I've had the pleasure of speaking with Lamar Jackson's personal quarterback coach on a few occasions. And the areas he spoke of that the quarterback needed improvement, even after an MVP campaign, are still apparent. He still needs to be consistently driving the ball outside the numbers and down the field. This is an area where he hasn't improved. And that's where it's holding him back, because you can compact the defense if you're not afraid for them to create the vertical chunk plays that may be available. And so that's why, to your point, yes, Baltimore is the more disappointing one because they haven't clicked to the same level we saw a year ago. But I think Tennessee losing crucial pieces has really seen their downside as of late.
Do you think that Lamar can – I understand last year, you know, he did it a little bit more. This year, he's basically abandoned throwing outside the numbers. Like, when you look at his throwing charts, it's startling to see how infrequently he really throws outside the numbers and pushes the ball down the field. He's got that awkward three-quarter arm motion, you know, the mechanics. Phillip Rivers has done it. He's had success throwing the ball down the field. But do you think, unless he makes alterations to his mechanics, that he's going to struggle consistently to throw outside the numbers and consistently pick up, like you said, those big chunk plays?
Well, I think a lot of it's lower body. And Lamar admitted it after his rookie season, particularly, that he would get lazy, that he wouldn't follow through on a lot of his passes, and that he wouldn't use the proper mechanics. I'm not one that says you need to change arm angles, you need to change throwing motion. I'm very much similar to the baseball analogy where you want to make, if a guy can throw 99 in the way he does it, just let him do it the way he does it. I know that's, in some ways, that's kind of outdated, but I that's the way I believe. I've seen it with Phillip Rivers here in Ohio. I saw with Bernie Kosar in the 80s, guys that could get the job done even though it wasn't your traditional way of throwing it. The question you have with Lamar is consistency within his mechanics, lower body and up, to be able to make those type of throws with any consistency itself. And to your point, with that motion, throwing motion, you tend to get your elbow up underneath and you'll sail balls. And we've seen that with him. And you will see that they've talked about changing his grip. I know that for a fact. And they have not decided to do it. And I'll tell you exactly why. And this is the reason. Kurt Warner told Lamar Jackson that he held the ball the same exact way. And from that point forward, Lamar has decided he's not going to listen to changing his grip. So But these are the little things that I know he's worked on that haven't quite met standards, and that they will continue to work on throughout the offseason and future years to try to make him a better overall passer.
Brent, the Detroit Lions in action again, and they almost blew that game last week to Washington, again leading by 17 points, and they've blown leads this season, big leads. Can anyone explain, is it the play calling gets too conservative? Is it because they have a defensive coach? Is it because their secondary gets exposed when teams have to throw the football and get back into the game? Can you explain why teams go down crazy points to the Lions and yet teams just crawl back against Detroit all the time, it seems?
Well, I think it's roster inefficiency. And by that, I mean they don't have a defense built in a manner that Matt Patricia wants them to play and the type of approach he expects after coming out of New England's coaching tree. So the two major issues they had coming into this year, first of all, you needed to improve your secondary. It was the worst in the NFL a year ago. You traded Darius Slay, who, by the way, has played really well this year after being traded out of Detroit. And you went out and drafted Jeffrey Okuda with a top five selection. Okuda has not played well. He's had a lot of rookie mistakes, and you can expect those growing pains, but at the same time, you thought he would have been better overall, better prepared for the NFL. So there's still issues there. The other issue is this. They are another one of those teams that does not have the consistency within their pass rush. They've been looking for that edge rusher for literally multiple years now, and they don't have the guy that will consistently draw attention from opposing offenses. And so when you don't have those guys capable of consistently winning one-on-one matchups, especially on obvious passing downs when teams are behind, then that makes you incapable of putting away a game. And yes, they have the firepower offensively. You have Matthew Stafford. DeAndre Swift's a great young and good-looking running back. But at the same time, if you don't have all the pieces in place on the other side of the ball, it's very hard to keep modern NFL offenses down, and that's really where Detroit still struggles.
Brent Sobleski, NFL analyst for the Bleacher Report. Brent, great stuff. Thanks for this.
Thanks, gentlemen. You guys have a nice evening and stay safe.
There he goes, Brent Sobleski. Have you seen, Josh, that on ESPN, on their fantasy app, that Taysom Hill is designated as a tight end?
Yeah,
how ridiculous is that?
I guess coming into the season, I know, you know what, there's no justification. He's listed as a quarterback on the depth chart. He's a quarterback. End of story.
Yeah, because and if you're playing Taysom Hill in ESPN League and somebody starts him at tight end this week, that is so wrong on so many levels.
Well, it's just it's such a loophole, right? You can basically play another tight end at a terrible position. Tight end has been a dumpster fire even more than most years. It's usually terrible every year, but basically this year, if you don't have Kelce, Kittle's hurt, Darren Waller's pretty good, Mark Andrews has been terrible, relatively speaking, and everyone else is just useless. You know, Taysom Hill, even if he has a mediocre game as a quarterback this week, which is possible if not likely, he's still probably giving you 15 points, which could be a weak winner at tight end.
Right. And again, it would just drive me nuts if I was playing a guy in ESPN who started Taysom Hill at tight end. It just feels like you're disrespecting the game. That's what it is. It's just way too much of a loophole and just feels funny to me. And hopefully ESPN changes their mind and flips around that designation so you can't start Taysom Hill as a tight end. Because when does he line up and catch pass? Has he caught a pass as a tight end this year? Like, I don't
he
even know.
He has caught a couple of passes, but I don't know.
But why
is
he a tight end and not wide receiver? Because he's in a blocking position?
Like, I guess,
I don't even know. It's ridiculous. He's not a tight end. He's a quarterback. All right, we'll talk some pucks. Jonathan Davis, host on SiriusXM NHL Radio, will join us. Still taking your texts and your tweet. Shoot us a text, 590-590, name and location. Best three places to have a beer where it just tastes a little different. We'll read those. We'll talk some pucks with Jonathan Davis next. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here till 11 p.m. At the top of the clock, Ryan Spader, co-host of the Walk Off Podcast, author of the incredible baseball stats, the coolest, strangest stats and facts in baseball history. We'll talk about Major League Baseball, the offseason, which of course moves at a snail's pace as the NBA offseason has kicked off tonight, later on in the 9 o'clock hour as well. Dragon's Breath makes its triumphant return to Sportsnet tonight. But to talk some pucks, Jonathan Davis is a host on Sirius XM NHL Radio. Jonathan, how are you? Thanks for this.
I'm doing well. And, George, I'm going to tell you now that if I lose any money betting football this weekend, I'm blaming it on you. I've told my wife. It's your fault.
Why on me? What's going on? Have you been tailing me for some reason?
No, George. I actually heard one of your hits earlier today, and I figured, you know what? I'm just going to – I bought everything you said, and so, I'm just going to blame it on you.
Okay, I don't blame you. If you want to do the prop stuff is what I'm good at. So follow me on Twitter. I sent out these big long write-ups.
You do
on
a
my
really good job. You guys do a good
thank
job.
Thank you. I sent out last night Christian Kirk over 48.5. He was money in the bank. Barely got over, but it's still a winning ticket. The NHL and this disagreement with escrow and now deferring player salaries. This doesn't feel like anything that we're not going to have hockey, does it?
No, I mean, they will find a way to get through it. I mean, it's not the ideal situation for any, for the players, but I think that in some ways they likely anticipated that this was going to happen, and it has. And, they're going to have to figure out, they're going to have to figure out a way, and hopefully, within the next 7 days, we can get something done, because I just can't see. If we don't get something done within the next 7 days, I'm not really sure when we can get something done.
Well, that's the thing.
January 1st. Let me preface that.
Well, and one thing I'm curious, and I was reading this earlier today, how much do you think that, Christmas and holiday time might factor in? I'm sure, when push comes to shove, they just want to get a deal done and figure out how to make this as fair as it possibly can be for both sides, considering the circumstances. But do you think that maybe the players will push more when it's all said and done for a mid type January start, so they can spend the holidays with their families instead of ramping up training at training camp and preseason as they get set to drop the puck basically a week later?
I think they've had enough time with family, and I think the guys that I talk to, I get a sense they want to get back on the ice. They want to be able to play as many games as possible because, if we are talking about a deferral, and I believe that we are talking about a deferral, the more games we play, the less of a deferral, there's likely to be. So I think that, everyone's keeping in mind, at the back end, with the Olympics, the end of July and what that means for NBC here in the States and, how that affects schedule. So, look, I think guys just want to get started. I think the big difference right now, guys, is that, whereas the first time around, I think there were players that were more players that were less inclined to want to come back. I think there are just more owners that are less inclined to want to come back because, they would do far better with the buildings closed than open. And I keep hearing a lot of owners that want to sell.
That's interesting. And is that what we forget about here, Jonathan? Because we all want the game to be back, and generally speaking, all the Canadian franchises are healthy financially, and they could absorb some of these losses with not having butts in the seats. But a lot of those U.S. teams aren't making a ton of money, and there's always that adage that's always a lot of people snicker about. You want to go from a billionaire to a millionaire by an NHL team.
Yeah, I mean, look, close to you guys in Buffalo, we know what the Pegulas are going through. Tough times for them. In Arizona, the new ownership, they're in the casino business. Not a good time. In Los Angeles, the Anschutz Entertainment Group, not the best time to be in that industry. One of the few owners that I think is probably doing quite well and thriving is Bill Foley in Vegas, who he's in the wine business. I don't think his business is suffering.
Oh, yeah. I guess certain teams are probably, like, the Maple Leafs will be fine, you would think. I guess you know, those smaller market teams, I guess like the Arizonas, Florida, teams who are, I guess, fringe in terms of their attention from the fan base and how many fans they get. I guess, like, in terms of revenue, how much do you think teams like that are really going to be, I guess, hurt by this? And what kind of ramifications will it be a case of, you know, they're not going to be able to really be as aggressive spending in terms of player movement that they normally would? How do you think teams like that who are kind of operate on the margins as is could be impacted by this?
Well, there are a lot of things to dissect from there. I mean, Arizona's biggest issue is just, you know, look, their ownership, as I said, is in the casino business. That's where they, you know, that's where they were looking to fund their hockey team from, was from the casino business. And yeah, that's taken a big hit right now. And, you know, Arizona's got a lot of issues right at the present time, just, you know, off the ice as well. I mean, that ownership group is an absolute dumpster fire. And what they went through in the offseason, you know, from the Ekman-Larsson situation to, you know, their owners feeling that they could get a first-round draft pick for Ekman-Larsson. You know, they've got their own problems. You know, from a standpoint of just, you know, where teams are at financially, guys. I mean, look, we've got 19 teams that, you know, have, you know, less than $5 million in cap space. And I think it's 10 teams that are under, that have less than $1 million in cap space. And as we know, there's a difference between cap space and budget, as Brian Burke has said many times, you know, on your air. And that's another issue. But when you're already struggling and being able to, you know, not have the money to spend, and that's partly why we're seeing, you know, Mike Hoffman in his situation, you know, unsigned. There's just a lot of issues to deal with right now.
Jonathan Davis, host on Sirius XM NHL Radio, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. I know everyone's potentially in on an all-Canadian division if and when the season does start back up. Do you see a downside to that we're missing out on all these superstars who play south of the border? Is that the only downside, in your opinion?
Yeah, but I think that the upside is tremendous. I mean, look, I mean, you know, being a Canadian, I'm absolutely ecstatic for this Canadian division. You know, what it's going to do for the rivalries. I mean, you've already got, you know, the Battle of Alberta gets heightened, and now a rivalry potentially to be created between Vancouver and Calgary as well, with, you know, with Levo and Markstrom and Tanev now wearing Flames jerseys. You know, more Montreal-Toronto. I mean, look, rivalries, yes, created in the playoffs, but with the history, you know, we can see where that goes. And so, look, I think there's a lot to be gained from it. I think the big struggle is just, you know, look, six of those seven teams made the playoffs last year, and granted an expanded format. But, you know, you're going to have some good teams that aren't going to make the playoffs, and even the Ottawa Senators, who are likely, you know, not going to make the playoffs, a lot better, and they're going to make life miserable for those teams. So, you know, it's no easy picnic. There's going to be some good teams left out, no question.
I one of the things, and it's obviously far down the list of priorities, first off is obviously getting a deal done, and then free agents continuing to sign, like you mentioned, Hoffman. We can get into him a little bit more, but I'm curious how broadcasts are going to work. You know, if we're talking about these regional divisions and, you know, maybe they're doing baseball style series, I'll be curious, you know, regionally how that's going to work. You know, NBC south of the border, Sportsnet, they're the rights holders nationally in each respective country. I'm fascinated to see how, you know, the broadcasts work and, you know, just how it all goes for the NHL, you know, in both markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think that because we're not, you know, it's quite possible that what NBC decides to do is do what they did, you know, in the return to play and basically having, you know, one or two teams that will live in Canada. But I would think that since we're going to have three U.S. divisions, you know, they'll probably more likely to stick to games on the U.S. side of the border. And the games that they want to broadcast that are involving just the Canadian teams, do what they've done traditionally in the past and just take, whether, you know, take the Sportsnet feed. you know, or the TSN feed, you know, which who's ever broadcasting the game, because everyone's trying to save money, and there's no need to travel if you don't have to. I mean, we saw how it worked in being able to do games from a studio. So, look, everything's different. We'll learn on the run here. But I would think that the U.S. networks will probably stay in the U.S. to do games, you know, to actually have their footprint on the game.
Jonathan, Craig Custance of The Athletic wrote a piece where he talked to some prominent NHL agents, and they said some of the big names that potentially could get traded during the season, Steven Stamkos' name was thrown about, but the one I want to ask you about is Mitch Marner. Do you see a scenario where the Leafs will trade Mitch Marner this season?
I don't. I've asked some GMs, you know, a while ago. I was talking to a couple of GMs, you know, one, would you trade Marner for Doughty? Because I really believe that unless LA becomes relevant in two seasons, it would not shock me to see, you know, Drew Doughty wanting out of Los Angeles. And what does LA need? They need scoring. And what does Toronto need? They need an elite defenseman. So, but they said they would absolutely never trade Marner for Doughty. And so I don't see it. You know, look, Kyle Dubas has put him, you know, backed himself into a corner. It's, you know, it's well documented. Ideally, you know, he's tried to sell off some of the smaller parts, but God, when you've got a guy that's that talented, I wouldn't entertain moving him whatsoever. And I think Marner's game, guys, to be honest with you, I think Marner's game ultimately could be really geared more to the playoffs. I think he is a player that, like a Braden Point, is willing to pay the price at the biggest time of the year. So I would not move him.
So we talked a little bit about it. You know, there's still some real quality players available, and, you know, obviously finances are very uncertain. But you look at players, Sammy Vatanen, Mike Hoffman, Duclair had a good season, and obviously interesting situation there in Ottawa. At this point, do you think that guys like that are going to wait until, you know, maybe right before the season or perhaps into the season? How do you foresee some of these bigger type of free agents who are still remaining to, I guess, resolve their situation and find new homes?
Well, I think, you know, really what the issue is right now is that until there's a date to return to play, owners are in no rush to make any decision. So I think once we get that startup date, you know, then we'll start to see guys like Mike Hoffman find themselves a home. But I think right now that's a stumbling block. And then the other issue, you know, and dealing with, you know, the RFAs that are out there. I mean, Tampa's got a lot of work. You know, the Islanders have work to do. So I think everyone's just kind of waiting for, you know, probably, you know, I think we'll get more clarity on that situation, you know, in the next week to 10 days once we hear that, you know, we've got a return date.
Jonathan Davis covers the NHL for SiriusXM NHL Radio. Jonathan, thanks for this. This was great.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure, and enjoy your weekend. Good
there
luck.
He goes. Thank you.
Good luck Sunday, George.
Yeah, thank you. I'll need it. There he goes, Jonathan Davis, host on SiriusXM NHL Radio. I think we're all in on the Canadian division, but it's just be careful what you wish for, right, Josh? Because are you ready to watch Jets and Sens like four or five times this season?
Yeah, well, it's not perfect, right? There are going to be some stinky games because there are a couple of stinky Canadian teams. Like, I got to tell you, like, the Leafs, obviously, I think Montreal is going to be fun to watch this year. And I, as a Habs fan, I'm sure, you know, you're looking forward to seeing what, you know, all those pieces brought in, how everything fits. But, like, I don't particularly enjoy watching Calgary. I understand they brought in Markstrom and Tanev, and that they could be a tough team. Playoff team last year, great. Not a team I'm that excited to watch. Winnipeg, same deal. You know, Edmonton, McDavid, Draisaitl, sure, I'm happy to watch a ton of them.
Right.
Ottawa, no thank you, even though, you know, they're on the upswing. And Vancouver, Pedersen and Hughes are great, but and this might be a hot take, and I might get slapped on the wrist for this. I think the Canadian division might get kind of old relatively fast,
to
be honest.
I totally agree with you. I like I like the variety, and variety is the spice of life. I like the variety. I like when you watch a Leaf game, you know, they're playing the Kings on a Tuesday night. It's neat, like when they're playing out in Los Angeles.
Yep.
Like, stuff like that's fun to watch. I want to see, you know, Nathan MacKinnon here. I want to see, you know, Barkov play the Leafs, all these elite players. I want to see the Sabres and Leafs play. I want to see Jack Eichel. What is he going to do? I want to see all of that, like... Lots of interesting stuff, and we're going to be robbed of that because it's going to be the old Canadian division. What are your power rankings right now? Give me your top three teams in Canada right now as the rosters are constructed.
So I feel like it, based on roster construction, I guess you got to I know some people will obviously disagree. I think you probably have to go with the Leafs first. They had a... I would say a pretty good offseason considering all of the salary cap constraints. So I think you probably go with them one. Then, you know, it's kind of a mess after that. Like, is it Calgary two? I'm going to go Calgary two because they have the same roster that was right there for a playoff spot last year and, you know, almost knocked out Dallas in the playoffs. So bringing in Markstrom, I think, makes them number two. And then I'm going to go Edmonton number three. Their goaltending's still not amazing. It was probably between Edmonton and Montreal for me. You know, Vancouver, I didn't love what they did this offseason. I think there's a decent chance they take a step back or a half step back. But Edmonton, you know, McDavid, Dreisaitl, say what you want about Tyson Barrie. He was a horrible fit here in Toronto. Wouldn't surprise me if he fits in nicely there in Edmonton. And if they could get decent goaltending, I know it's Smith and Koskinen still, so that's not great. But based on what they did this offseason with their roster, I guess they brought in Kyle Turris also, which I thought was actually a pretty good pickup. They had a lot of those kind of sneaky moves to surround you know, their core. I like their forward group. It's going to come down to defense and goaltending like always. But based on everyone else in Canada, I think I give them the edge over Montreal by a slim margin.
I'm looking forward to watching the Battle of Alberta for the 19th time this season. It's going to, I think you're bang on when it's going to get old fast. Again, Leafs and Habs, it's great. Great. Leafs and Habs again for the 9th time this season. Let's fire it up.
Well, and again, think about this, George. What I'll say is, remember, I guess, how many lockouts ago, I guess, after the 04 lockout or whenever it was? Remember, division rivals used to play each other, I want to say, 8 times a year? And
yes.
Now they've changed that. That was too much. I didn't want to see – it was great. You know, I used to be able to – I would make a trip to go to at least one game in Montreal, see the Leafs and Habs and maybe the odd time Buffalo because there was more opportunities. But outside of that, it's just – it's too much. Now it's down to, what, 4? And I think that that's – really the sweet spot number. 8 is too much. 18 is too much. Way too much.
Yeah, we don't know what the schedule is going to look like because it might be a 60-game schedule. It might be 48 games. We don't know what the schedule is going to look like, but strap in. Jets and Sens, let's go for the 4th time in the last 3 weeks. Straight ahead, 2020 continues to deliver as, for some reason, scientists are trying to build super monkeys. We'll do that. And Ryan Spader, co-host of the Walk Off podcast, he's an author. We'll talk some baseball with him. It's Sportsnet tonight. It's George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here till 11 p.m. Straight ahead on the show, Ryan Spader, co-host of the Walk Off podcast. We'll talk some Major League Baseball free agency with Ryan. And at 9:25, strap in, the radio segment that has engulfed the nation, Dragon's Breath, returns, where Josh will square off head to head with our producer, Sho Ali, our resident Dragon Fanny. Sportsnet 590, the Fan's Dragon, will spit out fiery hot takes, and one of you will agree with the hot takes and one of you will go against Fanny. We'll do that at 9:25. But as we know, Josh, 2020 continues to be the year that continually kicks us all in the groin, and now news that Toronto is shutting down for a minimum of 4 weeks just adds on to the 2020 being a total garbage year. But for some reason, scientists in Germany and Japan are trying to develop super monkeys, Josh, so much so that they've injected stem cells, human stem cells, into fetuses of monkeys. I'm not going to get all to the proper terminology, but this is the story. To make their brains larger and for them to know language and comprehend things. Essentially, this is literally a Planet of the Apes style experiment that this German lab and this Japanese lab, the Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology in Germany and the Central Institute for Experimental Animals in Japan, have come together to make super monkeys Planet of the Apes style. Over under, Josh, because I host a gambling show Sunday mornings, 50 years before the monkeys are our overlords.
I'm gonna say over, but I okay. Like, God, I you know, would it surprise
we'll
me?
We'll be dead
like
by 20... the time the monkeys rule the world. Is that what you're saying?
I hope so, because you know, okay. I've seen all those Planet of the Apes movies. I don't need that in my life, though. It's like, just the thought of that would be terrifying. Monkeys are scary anyways. Like, I know some people think they're cute and like they're friend, like they can be friendly when they crawl up on you and, you know, they eat something out of your hand. Like, okay, I guess I get that. Monster human sized monkeys who probably have higher intelligence quotas than the average human. Yeah. Hard pass on that. Hard pass.
And not to mention, they're still a monkey and have all the characteristics of a monkey and can just dominate the human race. It's going to be great. So just to put things in good standing, I welcome our monkey overlords, Josh, and welcome to our planet. And please don't imprison me to be a slave for your monkey empire that will one day rule the world. It's just so 2020, and you hear these stories all the time. And why? Like, why are people putting money into this? Is this necessary? Is there a reason? Are we pining to make monkeys superhuman? Yeah. Like, is that what we're doing here?
Like, I'm sure that the objective is for some good, right? Like, the monkeys can be a partner of some kind in some study or some venture. But this is how bad things always happen. Oh, well, we have good intentions. We're just trying to make genetically enhanced super monkeys. That's where things get dangerous. Once you lose control of the monkeys.
Haven't we seen movies?
Exactly. Right. Haven't you ever seen a movie? What's going to happen? The monkey's going to turn on you when it knows it can, and it's all over and we're all doomed.
Okay, can I share something that is really dumb and that I've thought about recently with this whole coronavirus and the vaccine?
Yeah, let's go.
Maybe we're on the cusp of a zombie apocalypse because the coronavirus turns you into a zombie. The vaccine turns you into a zombie, Josh. You ever thought about that?
There are going to be people out there who hear that, and 100% will think that
tell me that thought hasn't crossed your mind once.
Well, what I'll say is I am excited to get a vaccine when it's safe. Do I want to be the first like percentage of people getting it? Probably not. Like, let other people get it just to, you know, make sure everything's okay. And I don't think that would ever happen. You're not going to get a drug that makes it to market. But I still don't need to be front of the line.
Again, I've seen movies, Josh. A big global pandemic, the cure is a vaccine that turns people into zombies that they didn't know.
So will we live in harmony as zombies with our super monkey overlords?
No.
Like, how would that go?
You know what? Maybe we're building super monkeys to combat the zombies so the human race can coexist with our monkey overlords.
Oh, man. None of this seems too outrageous because of the year that we've had. The super monkeys, you know what? I'm changing my mind. We're going under on 50 years. It's going to happen.
Cal from Kitchener, relax, George. The monkeys have no chance without an opposable thumb. That's not bad. Yeah, sure. Make fun of the monkeys. They're coming for you.
Yeah, you're
first.
Asking for trouble, man.
Yeah, no,
if they're
welcome.
They don't need thumbs to just bring down their monster fist or leg when they kick
a thousand feet
into the air.
Yeah, exactly. I welcome our monkey overlords. All right. Keep those texts coming in as well. Favorite places to have a beer, top three, where a beer just tastes different. Shoot us a text, 590-590, name and location. Hit us up on Twitter at RussickSN590, at JGoldberg12. Straight ahead, we'll talk some baseball with Ryan Spader and Dragon's Breath at 925. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Nights ranked in reverse order. Date night, medieval night, and number one, Sportsnet tonight. Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
In the books, 2 hours to go. Sportsnet tonight. George Russick, Josh Colbert here along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Straight ahead on the program in about 20 minutes or so, the segment that has just caught fire along the country of Canada, not only Canada, but I would say the Milky Way, Josh. Dragon's Breath makes its return to Sportsnet tonight. Hey, Dragon's Breath even made an appearance on Sportsnet 960 in Calgary and on Boomer in the Morning. Did you know that?
I didn't. You brought it over there?
Yeah, well, they heard it because I filled in on the morning show a couple weeks ago for Scotty Mack, and I busted out some Dragon's Breath on the morning show with Ziggy. They heard it in Calgary, and they wanted to play along. Do you want to hear the take that I gave them?
Yeah.
Tiger Woods, or not me, but Fanny, Sportsnet 590, the Fan's Dragon, spit out this take. Tiger Woods was not only going to win the Masters and defend his title, his win would mirror his victory in 1997.
Wow. That's strong. Man, who took the position of trying to prove that was in the realm of possibility, if not likelihood?
It was Ryan Pinder, I believe, had to defend that take. And God bless Ryan Pinder, because that is a fiery, fiery hot take.
God.
Of course, it didn't happen. Tiger had a 10 on 12 and then subsequently had 5 birdies in a row, which is obscene. But that did not happen for one Eldrick, who's playing with his son Charlie in a tournament coming up. I think we're all going to be sucked in to watching that as well, because Charlie seems like he's the real deal. Who do you think is going to have, at this point of their lives, a better professional career? Bronny Jr. or Charlie Woods?
Charlie Woods. Charlie Woods.
Really?
I just feel like, Bronny Jr., I think, has a chance to play in the NBA, but by all accounts is a good player, but is not amazing. Like, he has NBA prospects. Charlie Woods, like, if he stays committed to it, you see that swing. His dad, he seems to be into it. The sky's the limit there. Like, I don't know what Charlie Woods could be. I guess you don't really know what Bronny could be, but he's a little bit older, right? You know, approaching high school, generally speaking, unless he goes, you know, through a bit of a growth spurt, really, you know, finds another level to his game. Like, I just feel like Charlie Woods. I saw that swing. I'm all in on Charlie Woods.
Interesting. What has been interesting, sort of, is all the speculation, all the rumors surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays, who, according to Ross and Mark, are going to be busy either adding a free agent pitcher or a position player. To talk about the Major League Baseball offseason, Ryan Spader's the co-host of the Walk Off Podcast, author, Incredible Baseball Stats, the coolest, strangest stats and facts in baseball history. Ryan, thanks for this. How are you?
I'm doing great, gentlemen. I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm sorry about the confusion with my number the first time around.
Oh, these things happen. No problem. We have you now, and we're glad that you were able to jump on with us this evening. Hardcore baseball fans, how jealous are they of how quickly the NBA offseason turns and the drama which surrounds their offseason, opposed to the snail's pace that is Major League Baseball's offseason?
You know, to be completely honest with you, I don't think very much so, because I think the hardcore baseball fans are so invested in this game 9 months out of the year that they don't even really have an opportunity to pay much attention to the off seasons of other sports. So I think oftentimes you don't even realize how quickly some of the other sports are getting things done in the off season, specifically with the NBA. My my Sixers just signed Dwight Howard,
yeah.
But it's like 10 years too late there. So
you never know. You just won a championship. You never know how it could go. But looking at some of the rumors, there's so many that, like, is Lindor going to get traded? Where's Bauer going to end up? And then the other day, JP Morosi of MLB.com drops this whopper that, Nolan Arenado's available and the Dodgers might be interested. And I rolled my eyes a little bit at that one because I thought, there's no possible way. Even the Dodgers, there's a limit to this spending. Arenado's got a monster contract, and I can't see that. But do you think that, there might be some smoke there, or do you think that that's more than anything just kind of wishful thinking?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I think it's the kind of thing that the Rockies front office puts out just about every single year. I don't know if you recall, but we heard a lot of the same going on last year, and there was rumors that he might end up with the Phillies, or I think the Cardinals were thrown around. I think this is going to be something that we hear just about every single season. And you mentioned that contract, and I think it's a little bit overplayed to how expensive that contract is, because what you're looking at there is the best third baseman in baseball. Oftentimes you're going to hear people say that, he has the Coors effect benefiting him. But when he goes on the road, what he's dealing with is what I call the hangover effect. He's seeing breaking balls. He's not seeing 50% of his games. And without getting too much into the weeds in it, something that we actually dove into in the book, but without getting too deep into it, look at a guy like DJ LeMahieu, who's going to be one of the most sought-after free agents this offseason at second base, and what he did with the Yankees once he left Colorado. His offensive numbers really took a boost, where he started producing at the level that he was doing in Colorado, or close to it, across all of his games.
Ryan Spader is the co-host of the Walk Off Podcast, author of The Incredible Baseball Stats, The Coolest, Strangest Stats and Facts in Baseball History, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, Ryan, we're all about rumors here in Toronto. We're excited because the president and the GM saying the Blue Jays should be really active here in free agency or via trade. Do you see a possibility that Francisco Lindor could be a member of the Toronto Blue Jays when it's all said and done here? And do you think the Blue Jays are finally willing to trade some of that prospect capital that they were kind of hesitant to deal with the last couple of years?
So I think the Blue Jays are in a tough position when it comes to that. Of course, you think about it, and it's almost like a fantasy infield when you talk about getting, let's say, Vlad Guerrero Jr. at first base, Kevin Biggio at second, and then you could put Bichette or Lindor at third and short interchangeably. But I think, honestly, it's going to take maybe a Bo Bichette to get Lindor here, because I think a lot of teams are going to have quite a bit to offer for that player, a caliber player who's going to be an MVP candidate for the next 3, 4, 5 seasons. I don't see the Blue Jays being the team to be able to go out and get Lindor if they're not going to go ahead and give up Bichette. Having said that, I think that's something that I would definitely consider. I know that's probably making a lot of Blue Jays fans cringe, because Bichette's shown so much promise, and they'd probably rather give up a Biggio, but Biggio's a lot older there. He's actually pretty close to Lindor in terms of his age. I think the best route for the Blue Jays is to go through free agency. I really like their lineup. I think it's really strong. I would focus on pitching. I think, of course, you got to make a play for Bauer. I think just about every team does, especially when it's widely known that he's going to consider even just one-year deals. But I think what's crucial for the Blue Jays, and I'm going to say what's crucial for 29 other teams in baseball, is to make a play for Taijuan Walker, who they traded for. I think he's going to be the best free agent in terms of value for your dollar this offseason. You look at what he did when he came over to Toronto. Of course, only 6 starts, but he had a 1.37 earned run average, striking out a batter per inning. I think he's kind of finally discovered how to be a pitcher versus being that thrower that he was, or that he was labeled as
early in his career with the Mariners, and he's had some trouble with injuries, but it seems like he's really finally healthy. And if you look over his past three seasons since 2017, he's only got 43 starts during that span, but you're looking at an earned run average that's 40% better than league average. And that's what you're expecting out of a, let's say, I don't want to say quite a number one, but like a 1.5. So I say go ahead and make a play at Bauer. If you can't get him, maybe go for a Tanaka. But number one priority should be trying to re-sign Taijuan Walker.
Yeah, that's interesting because you know the Jays have certainly been rumored to be interested, and he, you know, has reciprocated and has been tweeting a lot. I'm still not totally sure. You know, he had a great season. I guess he's got a one plus pitch. I feel like, you know, his fastball does seem to really do a lot and was very effective this year. But you know, what's his upside? Do you think he can be, you know, a two in a rotation, or is he somebody who's best suited in the middle, like in your three, or best case, maybe even in the four spot in your rotation?
Oh, goodness. If you get him as a four, that's remarkable. I really think I expect him to, if you looked at the career trajectory of, say, a Trevor Bauer, of, say, a Jake Arrieta, I expect that type of upward momentum for him from here on out. He's been in the league since 2013, and he seems like this, you know, this old veteran and everything, but he just turned 28 years old, which is about the same time that we saw guys like Bauer, guys like Arrieta break out. And I'm telling you, he's figured out how to pitch. I really, really believe in this kid because that's really what he still is. He just pitched in his age 27 season. I really believe in what he's going to do. And I think his upside, I don't want to say he's going to be your bona fide ace Cy Young number one, but I really think his upside is going to be like a 1.5, slightly better than a number two.
Ryan, we know that we haven't seen the big blockbuster signings as of yet, but with all the uncertainty with the coronavirus, because I know baseball plans to play their 162-game schedule and home and away and have fans ideally in the stands, but is that kind of making teams a little gun-shy here to open up the purse strings and spend big on some free agents just based on who knows what the 2021 season is going to look like?
Well, it's funny you make the NBA comparison earlier because my fear is that we're going to see a separation that's in terms of standings that's similar to what we see in the NBA, where it's very top-heavy. We've already seen, just for one example, just recently, the Pirates DFA Trevor Williams, who's an absolute great pitcher. I mean, he didn't have the best year, but he's still got some good years ahead of him, and he's been an all-star. I think he was an all-star just last season. So you're going to see some of those teams who are just Pittsburgh, Florida, that, you know, don't have money to spend, and they're not going to spend it, and they're going to fall further down in the standings. And then teams that do have money, your Yankees, your Blue Jays now, your Dodgers, you're going to see some even greater separation than there has been in the past. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if we see that separation similar to the NBA, as I said.
You know, looking at Springer specifically, Jays and a lot of teams will be interested in him. 31 years old, you know, there's always concern about the aging curve and is the defense going to be there? Is the bat speed going to be there? Do you have concerns about how he'll age on a potentially a five-year deal, or do you look at his profile and say that whether he's in center or maybe has to move to a corner, the bat will be there for the lion's share of that kind of deal?
As far as Springer goes, I have very little concern about him over the course of a five-year deal. But if you're getting up into those, it's difficult for me to say ridiculous because I think these players are paid what they deserve. They're just bringing in so much money to this game. But if you can get him over a five-year deal, I think it's going to take probably 5-120. I think that's going to be a deal that's going to get your money's worth. He had he was worth two wins above replacement over just 51 games last season. That puts him at a trajectory of about six over the course of a full season, which is what he was at in 2019. He stumbled a bit in 2018, but the previous three seasons, he was better than four wins above replacement in each one of them. His sprint speed has been consistent over the last three, 4 seasons. He actually is in the top 18% in terms of speed, which is something that catches some people off guard because George Springer, you know, stole one base last year. But he's a pretty good base runner. He's a great defensive player. Maybe he's not going to give you 150 games, although he played all 162 in 2016 when he was just 26. But I think that if Springer goes anywhere over the course of a five-year deal, a team is going to get their money. I think where the problem starts to enter into the conversation is if you start talking about years beyond five. And I think that that's what's going to happen most likely. Although, given all the circumstances that you just mentioned regarding this virus and everything, perhaps it's going to be a situation where you see the player, in this case Springer, settle for a little bit of a shorter-term deal in that 4 to 6 year range.
Ryan Spader's co-host of the Walk Off Podcast, author, Incredible Baseball Stats, the coolest, strangest stats and facts in baseball history, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. I know a lot of Blue Jays fans would love to see a DJ LeMahieu at the top of this lineup. He's a guy who's versatile too, can play a couple positions. But we hear, according to baseball insiders, the Yankees and the Mets have an inside track on him. Is there any way he doesn't sign with one of those two New York teams, Ryan?
Of course. I mean, everybody's going to, not everybody, but there's going to be a number of teams who are able to open up the pocketbook or able to open up their wallet and try to go for a DJ LeMahieu. But I really look for the Mets to make some big splashes this offseason. I think they're going to make a play at LeMahieu and also a play at JT Realmuto. Being a Philadelphia fan, that kind of upsets me. But it just seems like that's the direction that team's going to go in. They're going to be the big spender. They have the wealthiest owner in all of baseball, and it's by far, it's not even close. And I think he's going to want to make a good impression on that fan base, given how poor ownership has been for the New York Mets over the past decade plus. As far as the Yankees go, I think Yankees fans will be very upset if they can't bring back DJ LeMahieu, and it's probably in their best interest to do so. He was the cornerstone of that offense, batting at the top of the order. I'm not sure they're going to be able to if the Mets can outplay them for their own guy. Is there a chance he's not going to end up on one of the New York teams? Of course, but I would say it is. If I was a betting man, which I am from time to time, I would put it on LeMahieu staying in New York, maybe changing uniforms.
What do you think about James Paxton? Any chance he sticks around New York? He's somebody I think a lot of Blue Jays fans, you know, I have certainly made no secret. I think James Paxton would be a great fit here on a, you know, incentive type of 1 or maybe 2 year deal. I expect a lot of suitors, a lot of upside, a lot of risk with the injuries. What do you expect to see, you know, in terms of Paxton, in terms of landing spots?
So, you know, it's funny you mentioned Paxton as somebody who has a lot of upside, because I actually – now, bear in mind, this was before any of this virus stuff came out and we knew what was going to happen here. But I actually pegged James Paxton as my sleeper candidate for the Cy Young Award last year around, I want to say it was like January or so. He has never pitched a full qualified season at this stage in his career, which is remarkable. So he's got a lot of innings in that arm, but injuries have still plagued him. I think when he can, if he can put it together, you know, put something together like that 2017-2018 campaign that he had with the Mariners, or even 2019 where he wasn't quite as good, but with New York. I think he's – you mentioned when I mentioned Walker, you mentioned, you know, what's his upside? Is he a number one? Well, I think that's what Paxton's upside is. Yeah. If he can put it together to stay healthy, he's a number one. Now, what it's going to take to sign him, you talk about an incentive-laden deal. I don't think that that's going to get Paxton. I think what's going to get Paxton is going to be the sure money, the team that's willing to take that risk. And I think he's sort of a, let's say, a high-risk, high-reward type of pitcher right now.
Ryan, we know that a lot of Red Sox fans were eating it watching Mookie Betts and his success with the Dodgers ultimately winning a World Series. And again, it was cost certainty why they traded Mookie Betts, because they didn't want to give him that crazy lucrative deal that he signed in Los Angeles. How busy do you anticipate the Red Sox to be this offseason?
I got to be honest with you. On the Red Sox, I'm kind of drawing a blank. It's interesting because now they're bringing back their manager, and Alex Cora, and it seemed like they had almost after he got suspended, I guess, almost like a pregnant pause last season. They expected to do almost nothing, and that's what they did. They were cellar dwellers all season. I don't know how much they can do to be a team that's going to compete in the East immediately. And of course, that all depends on what are we going to do with the postseason next year? Is it going to be the same? How's it going to change? But I think going forward, you're looking at an NL East that's going to be mainly three teams competing in the Blue Jays, the Yankees, and the Tampa Bay Rays.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, you're always plugged into the comings and goings on the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot, and this is an interesting year because there's nobody who's really a slam dunk. You know, Todd Helton has his druthers. Scott Rolen, I think, is a Hall of Famer, and his candidacy seems to be on the ascent. Do you think there's a chance we could see no one get in this year, especially with the holdover year and, you know, the ceremony being last year's scheduled for this summer? Or do you think that, you know, maybe somebody like Rolen has that kind of spike where he could get in this kind of year?
So I'll tell you, and I'm not sure if you gentlemen have seen, what I do every year is I poll the players as to who they think belongs in the Hall of Fame. I always get very interesting results that are sort of combative with what BBWAA ends up going with. For example, you mentioned Helton, who I believe is a Hall of Famer, as I mentioned earlier with the Coors and the hangover effect. But Helton's polling right now, it's 70% with the players, 73.3% if you give them unlimited votes. Players have Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens in the Hall of Fame. I think both of those guys are going to fall around 70% this year with the writers. I think if only one is to get in this year, it's going to be Curt Schilling. I think he will finally get in the Hall of Fame. Not the most popular guy in the world, but if you go back last season, he had an interview with Bob Costas, and I think Bob did him a great service in the way that that interview went, the way the questions were presented to him. And then Kirk did, to his credit, because, not the most popular guy in the world, but to his credit, he did a nice job answering the questions, as challenging as they were at times. So I think it's going to be the year that Schilling finally gets into the Hall of Fame. I think on their ninth year in the ballot, in Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, I think they're going to get close. And then finally next year, and then Helton, Rolen, Andrew Jones, I expect all of those guys to have massive jumps and then eventually get into the Hall of Fame. I'm looking at Jones and Rolen to sort of have a trajectory similar to that of Tim Raines, Larry Walker, Edgar Martinez, and then eventually get into the Hall of Fame. However, with those guys, I think baseball writers in general each year, as some of the newer, younger writers are getting votes, as a whole, seem to be a little bit more learned than they have been in the past. So I don't think it's going to take those gentlemen the full 10 ballots to get into the Hall of Fame, as we saw with Walker, Edgar, and Tim Raines.
Ryan Spader is the co-host of the Walk Up Podcast, author of Incredible Baseball Stats, the coolest, strangest stats and facts in baseball history. Ryan, where do we get the book?
Oh, on my website or Amazon. I just like talking baseball. You guys don't have to plug all that stuff. It doesn't bother me. I just like talking baseball with people. I have a good time. Just have me back and we're even, all right?
All right, sounds good. Thanks for this, pal. We'll talk again soon.
All right, have a great day.
There he goes. If there's one thing, right, and great question about the Baseball Hall of Fame, and obviously It's interesting, I can't stand that the baseball writers are like the beacon of morality, that these writers are such flawless human beings that they're so critical of the steroid era, or how this guy treated the media at one time, or Kurt Schilling's political views. Like, come on, it's about numbers. It's about numbers and their impact. That's all it is. I can't stand that the baseball writers have all these other things that, that they put into, like that one douche who didn't vote. Was it Derek Jeter?
Yeah.
Derek Jeter wasn't a Hall. Really? Because he wasn't nice to you the one time he had a one-on-one interview with you? Like, I just don't get it, and it drives me nuts sometimes.
100%. And yeah, there's too much bias and, you know, grandstanding involved in the process. Like, yeah, Bonds, Clemens, I understand, you know, if you're
hesitant.
Jerks. Yeah, they're jerks. Did they cheat? Most likely. Did everyone cheat or a lot of people cheat at the time?
Yes.
Bonds and Clemens should be Hall of Famers. Independent of that, they had already had Hall of Fame careers. I've been, like a lot of people, banging that drum for a very, very long time. Is Kurt Schilling a turd? Yeah, he's a turd. Like, I don't think it's outlandish to say Kurt Schilling's a turd. But does he belong in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. Kurt Schilling was an incredible pitcher, big game pitcher, big money pitcher, great success in the regular season, obviously great success in the postseason. You can't necessarily just punish him because he's a turd. Like, he does. Lots of bad guys are in the Hall of Fame. Ty Cobb is
killed somebody.
Horrible guy in the Hall of Fame. Kurt Schilling should be in the Hall of Fame. I don't, you know, any grandstanding or complaints about character or anything like that. Kurt Schilling's a Hall of Famer, and honestly, hopefully he gets in this year.
All the players from over before black players were allowed to play in baseball are in the Hall of Fame. You didn't even play against the best, and they're all in the Hall, and nobody, that's fine. Babe Ruth didn't play against all the best players around at that time. He didn't. And oh no, but that's fine. But oh no, Kurt Schilling has a couple stupid tweets, and you can't have some crazy political views. You can't put him in the Hall of Fame. It just drives me nuts. Anyway,
I we'll see what happens. I think he'll get in, but there's too much stuff like that involved with it. It's too much, with bias and opinion. Like, separate all of that, and does the guy deserve to be in or not? And if he does, put him in.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, straight ahead, the radio segment that is just catching fire, literally, around this country, and I'd say the universe. We'll do some Dragon's Breath next, and later on this hour, Marc Gasol, wait, he's not going to Spain, and wait, he's not going to sign with the Raptors? We'll do that later on this hour as well. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here. Later on this hour, rumors that Marc Gasol could be out of Toronto officially. And at the top of the clock, Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic. We'll talk some NBA free agency. And the producer of the program is Show Ali. He'll join us for another edition of Best in Show. Show is on the line now to play some Dragon's Breath. Show, are you there with us?
I'm here, George.
Are you excited?
I can't wait. I've only done Dragon's Breath with you and Fanny one time, I think, with Andy, when the inaugural edition, I think. So I'm excited to do it again.
Josh, correct me if I'm wrong. Is this your second foray into Dragon's Breath?
Second foray, yeah.
All right. So, Josh, because you're the co-host tonight, are you going to defend Fanny's takes? Or are you going against the Sportsnet 590 The Fan resident Dragon?
I'll try and defend him.
Oh, wow. You're jumping on her takes. I love it. I love it because usually they're scorching hot.
Yeah,
get ready to defend some of these takes. Technical director Tom Young, let's fire up Dragon's Breath for tonight. Let's do it.
It's now time for the hottest of hot takes. So hot, in fact, that we needed the help of our Sportsnet 590 The Fan Dragon, Fanny. This is Dragon's Breath. Here's your host, George Russick, who, by the way, is fluent in Dragon.
I certainly am, and as I mentioned numerous times already on Dragon's Breath, I took it at Niagara College, and I'll be honest, barely passed the class. But are you ready for some Dragon's Breath? Josh, are you ready to defend the first take that our Sportsnet 590 The Fan Dragon is about to spit out. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Tom Young, let's fire it up. Okay. All right. Okay. Wow, this one's timely. The take is this, Josh. If Serge Ibaka and Fred VanVleet leave via free agency, the Raptors should trade Kyle Lowry.
Okay, so here's how I'll approach this. You could just say, well, if VanVleet's gone and Lowry's gone, you have no point guard. I still think Lowry has a good amount of value, and I think, you know, the Raptors' championship window right now is not open. They're not a contender to win the title with Lowry on the team. You know, Giannis doesn't seem all that likely, and there's nobody else realistically that I think is going to be an impact. So I think you try and stockpile assets here, and you turn this team over as much as you can to Siakam and Ananobi, and you give this Flynn kid a chance at point guard, and you bring in maybe a decent point guard back in a trade. But I honestly don't know if Kyle Lowry's trade value would ever be higher than it is right now, realistically, like in this stage of his career. And, you know, maybe there's something to be said for just seeing what you've got with a new era of Siakam and Ananobi, and I might feel a little bit stronger about it if Terrence Davis's status wasn't as uncertain as it is. But I do think that there is a world in which a Lowry trade could net back a decent amount and not lead the Raptors to the seller or a rebuild or anything like that. I think they've built enough up here where they could a good amount of value for him and still be in a pretty good position.
Interesting. Sho Ali, if Serge Ibaka and Fred VanVleet leave via free agency, why shouldn't the Raptors trade Kyle Lowry?
Well, I guess in the end, I see a lot of the points Josh is making, but in the end, Kyle Lowry is the greatest Raptor of all time, right? And I think, and again, I know the sports is a business and you shouldn't be sentimental about players, but Kyle Lowry is going to have a statue of him bronzed, probably taking a charge outside Scotiabank Arena at some point in the not too distant future. And not only should you keep him for legacy reasons, I think he'll be valuable to whoever ends up as the point guard of the future, right? Like, let's say Malachi Flynn is the new Fred VanVleet in 2 to 3, maybe 4 years, hopefully a little sooner than that. But I think having Lowry around would be immensely beneficial to the development of someone like Malachi Flynn, someone like maybe a Jalen Harris, because Josh is right, the future of Terrence Davis even is uncertain. But at the same time, getting rid of Kyle Lowry could not be any worse for the development of some of the younger point guards and younger guards, period, on the Toronto Raptors roster.
All right. Interesting stuff. Take two here from our resident Sportsnet 590 The Fan Dragon. Let's hear it, Tom. Fire it up. Okay. Joe, you'll go first, and you're going to disagree with this smoking hot take. If Vladdy Jr. for Francisco Lindor is on the table, the Jays should pull the trigger immediately.
Immediately? Jeez, okay. Well, here's the thing. I know people have been disappointed with Vladdy Jr. I've been disappointed. Absolutely no question. You want to see more. It's not helped by the fact that guys like Biggio and certainly Bobichet have come in and been so much more exciting, so much more impressive to watch from the word go. But at the same time, I feel like we can't really judge what Vladdy is, even if the return is someone like Francisco Lindor. Okay, Francisco Lindor is certainly probably a top 10 player in baseball right now. So if I get the appeal, but at the same time, if Vladdy Jr. only has the amount of at bats that he does, I feel like I want to see him get another full season, maybe even another full 2 seasons before I can judge. And I would hate to see him get traded to the Cleveland Indians and watch him get those at bats and then blow up. And then you shake your heads about all the other things that have happened over the years.
Josh, if Vladdy Jr. for Lindor is on the table, why should the Jays pull the trigger immediately?
Because realistically, Vladdy Jr. is never going to be
the kind of impact player that Francisco Lindor is. Defensively, no chance. He's already been moved to first base. You know, power-wise, he could get there, but I just the expectations we could be partly to blame for this were probably too high. You're talking about MVPs, Miguel Cabrera, all of that was probably a little bit much. He could be an all-star a bunch of times, but Lindor, I think, is potentially on a trajectory to the Hall of Fame, is already one of the best players in the league, could win MVPs. Obviously, it's all contingent on a contract, but anyone would feel that way making any trade. I just feel like Lindor, for the next 5-7 years, will be a better, vastly better ball player than Vlad Jr. You move Bichette to second base. You know, it would be a shame if Vladdy goes on to be a great player for Cleveland, but I still don't think for the, like, window that the Jays have right now that he's anywhere a good chance, a likelihood of him being a more impactful major leaguer than Frankie Lindor.
All right, two takes down from Fanny, two to go. Tom, let's hear take number three from our resident Sportsnet 590 The Fan Dragon. Well, Josh, we'll start with you. This is a beauty. Taysom Hill will keep the starting quarterback job for the Saints even when Drew Brees returns from injury. Defend the take, Josh Goldberg.
This one I don't think is that hard to defend. Drew Brees hadn't been playing amazingly. Yeah, his completion percentage hadn't been, I think it's the best in the league, but that's the usual. A lot of dinking and dunking. The ceiling isn't really there with that offense anymore, I don't think, with Drew Brees at the helm. You look at the three games, let's say, two against the Falcons, one against the Broncos, all very winnable. Taysom Hill just has to play good football, and they win all three games, and he showcases, you know, that upside, that dual threat. He makes a lot of exciting plays, explosive plays. He gets Michael Thomas more involved. He continues to use Kamara, and the offense just looks harder to defend, and they win all three games. Then I think, you know, you make the conversation that, as tough as it is, he's 41 years old, probably is maybe his last year, if not probably his last year, before he heads off into the broadcast booth. Maybe Taysom Hill is the guy that can give you a little bit more and raise the ceiling on the offense than Drew Brees at this stage.
Shoaly, why isn't Taysom Hill going to keep that starting quarterback job for the Saints when Drew Brees comes back?
Maybe because Taysom Hill, when you watch him play football, you think to yourself, man, is this guy really an NFL quarterback, right? I mean, he has insane athleticism, but just like Sean Payton's love affair, by the way, with Taysom Hill is one of the most baffling things, I think, in maybe the entire NFL. And here's the thing, though, George. I think the Taysom Hill experiment is going to start and end this weekend with that Falcons game. But I also do think that when, even if Drew Brees does return from injury, I think it might end up being Jameis Winston at the who ends up taking the starting reign for New Orleans.
Interesting. That's three takes down, one to go from our resident Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Dragon Fanny. This is Dragon's Breath along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg, Shoaly. Tom Young, let's hear the last take. Let's fire it up. Okay, this is a doozy. Sho, are you ready to disagree with the stake?
Let's do it.
If the Maple Leafs play in an all-Canadian division, Toronto will finish fifth and miss the playoffs.
Oh, my goodness. That is spicy, but yeah, I feel like nobody here listening to this program right now, listening to that take, is going to like it too much, because it's hard to look at all the Canadian teams and think that there are four teams so head and shoulders better than the Toronto Maple Leafs as presently constructed, especially after all the moves Kyle Dubas went out and made to make the team quote-unquote tougher to play against. He improved the D-line. He improved the bottom six. He gave other guys new contracts. Like, I feel like when it comes to, especially when you stack them up to the rest of these Canadian teams, like, even if they, maybe they don't finish first, sure, that's possible. There's no chance they finish out of the top four, especially when you still have teams that are question marks like Montreal. The Sens are not making the playoffs. The Calgary Flames probably will, but I mean they've lost a couple pieces and have some new ones as well. The Canucks took a step back because they have the cap crunch. It's just when you really whittle it down, there's just, even if you don't think the Leafs are that good, and I personally do think they're a very good team, there's just not a lot of room for other teams to sneak up ahead of them, it feels like.
Interesting. Josh, we'll end it with you. If the Maple Leafs play in an all-Canadian division, Toronto will finish fifth and miss the playoffs.
Well, it's problematic that we talked about the Canadian division and I ranked the Leafs as the number one team. So that kind of contradicts what I'm about to say. But for the purposes of this, you know, it's still pretty top-heavy. Thornton, Spezza are old. Their bottom six, you know, they brought over all these. Barabanov, Nick Robertson. Are they going to get anything in the bottom six? Very fair to question that. Can their top six be good enough? I think, like, it's probably more likely than not. But, you know, the blue line, how's TJ Brody going to fit? Is Freddie Anderson going to be good? Is Jack Campbell going to be good? You know, the Leafs, you know, the margin for error isn't as great, I think, as everyone assumes. You know, it's probably more likely than not that they will make the playoffs, but I don't think it would be a huge, huge, huge surprise if a lot of things don't go right, a couple of injuries, bad goaltending, bad defense, and they're in a nip-and-tuck battle to even make it and end up missing out.
Wow, that's four spicy takes up and four spicy takes down. There's only one thing left to do. Our Dragon, she kind of tells us who wins Dragon's Breath for tonight. Just spoiler alert, guys, she generally picks the person who agrees with their takes. Tom, let's hear from Fanny on who wins tonight's edition. Josh Goldberg, congratulations, you won Dragon's Breath for tonight. I think you defending... Yeah, I think you defending the Maple Leafs finishing fifth in the All-Canadian Division and missing the playoffs must have been a tough pill to swallow. Sho Ali, out of all those takes, which one did you kind of go, that probably makes a lot of sense?
You know what? Probably the Vladdy Jr. for Lindor take, okay. I gotta say. Honestly, all like right. I think that I do actually want to see Francisco Lindor in a Blue Jays uniform. I would love to keep Vladdy, but I mean, if that was on the table, I'd be the next guy on the phone to call Ross Eck and say, take the deal! Take it.
Josh, which one was the hottest take?
The Raptors trading Kyle Lowry's an incinerator. Like, you get too close. It's like, that take is like the sun. You get too close. You stare at that thing for too long. Like Donald Trump all those years ago looking at the eclipse, you're in trouble. Like, if you stare at that
Icarus
thing.
It's the Icarus of sports takes.
For sure. Like, you, that thing, you can't fly too close to it. Otherwise, you're going down.
All right, that's another edition of Dragon's Breath in the books. Big thanks to technical director Tom Young, who dipped his toe into the Dragon's Den. All right, straight ahead, Marc Gasol leaving the Raptors, maybe. We'll talk about that. And Seth Hartnell, NBA analyst for The Athletic. All straight ahead, Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here to the top of the clock. Straight ahead on the program, we'll talk NBA free agency with Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic. But Josh, as we were on the air, things happening around the NBA. Well, let's first talk about a Mark Stein tweet sent about 45 minutes ago. Marc Gasol has emerged as a free agent target for the Lakers to fill the void created by Dwight Howard's departure to Philadelphia. And now, all of a sudden, in the last few minutes, the Lakers have signed the reigning sixth man of the year, Montrezl Harrell to a two-year deal, which seems like a fantastic signing for the Lakers. Does that mean Marc Gasol is not going to Los Angeles?
I would think not. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the Lakers now are capped out. So Marc Gasol, unless he's taking a minimum deal, his market, I think, would be enough that he could get, you know, $5 million per season at this rate, like maybe on a 2-year deal. So I think that probably takes him out. Just interesting, you know, I wonder what his status is with the Raptors. Like, if Ibaka's gone, does that make it more likely that he's back? If Ibaka's back, you know, does that make it less likely? I really wonder if Ibaka's status is at all, you know, kind of a domino in terms of what Gasol might or might not do.
Well, and you got to love, if you're a Lakers fan, you got to love what they've done so far this offseason. I love the Dennis Schroeder deal. Great piece off the bench. And now you get Montrezl Harrell. And clearly they're just waiting, Anthony Davis waiting out to see how things are going to work out with his contract. But they're going to sign Anthony Davis. Fresh off a championship, Josh, the Lakers look even better now than they did last season.
Yeah, Schroeder, you know, and Harrell have their defensive issues, but you know, when you have Anthony Davis kind of anchoring your defense, a lot of that stuff might go out the window. And Wes Matthews is a really good pickup. You know, Milwaukee, right. Him leaving Milwaukee for a similar type of deal. He's a little bit older, but he's a good shooter and he's a good defender. And what do you want around LeBron and Anthony Davis? What did we see in the run to the finals? Timely shooting, good defense. You know, they lost Howard, right. who was effective for them, but Harrell's, I think, probably, you know, he's an upgrade. I don't think that there's any getting around that. And, you know, they lost Danny Green, but Wes Matthews, that's probably a good trade-off. And we'll see what happens with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who they have. I think they can go over the cap to sign. And I would expect at this point he'll be back, you know. And it's just another Rich Paul clutch sports. Montrezl Harrell's a clutch guy. Schroeder, I believe, is a clutch guy. I think somewhat recently, obviously, LeBron and AD. And KCP is a clutch guy. And it's just interesting how they've done so much business with that team in LA, with LeBron's buddy, his longtime friend Rich Paul, running the show.
Right. And what a double bonus for the Lakers and their fans. Not only do you get the sixth man of the year, he also played for the Clippers last season. Yeah. And the Clippers just got worse because Montrezl Harrell decided to switch dressing rooms and play for the Los Angeles Lakers. The NBA offseason continues to be super fascinating. We'll talk about it with Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic, straight ahead. And we'll do some best in show with our producer, Shoali, in the 10 o'clock hour. That's straight ahead. It is Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Don't get left in the dark. Let us shine a light on everything you need to know. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Three hours in the books, one to go. Sportsnet Tonight, George Russick, Josh Goldberg, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Later on this hour, the producer of the program is Shoali. He'll join us for another edition of Best in Show. But NBA free agency delivering the goods tonight. To break it down, Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic. Seth, how are you?
I'm fine. Right as you guys were doing your break, they got another like three or four deals got tweeted out. So just trying to keep up with everything that's going on.
There is a lot to process. What I want to ask you about is the big move by the Lakers. They have signed the reigning sixth man of the year, Montrezl Harrell, to a 2-year deal away from the Clippers. Can I just say that that's good news secretly for the Raptors, because Kawhi loses a key piece of his team and won't win a championship with the Clippers? Am I reaching?
A little. I don't think that the Clippers had much desire to have him back next year. I think that some of the shortcomings that Harrell had as a top line player were, I think, revealed in their second round loss in the playoffs. So I don't think that they're shedding many tears at that half in LA.
So yeah, like The Harrell thing's really interesting because, yeah, he's a sixth man of the year and had a great regular season and then was awful in the bubble. Obviously, his grandmother passed away, and you have to factor that in and factor in the bubble. Sure. But he can't really play defense. And, like, I expect he'll get a ton of dunks in pick-and-roll situations with LeBron and Schroeder. But, like, do you imagine he's a crunch-time option for Frank Vogel, or do you think he's somebody who you lean on in the regular season and in the first three quarters, but when push comes to shove in the nitty-gritty time, he might not actually see the floor?
I think that's right, but I think at the contract the Lakers signed him to, that's okay. Yeah. It's, you know, they got him for basically the mid-level exception and a guy who's going to, you know, give you, you know, 20, 25 minutes a game through most of the first three quarters, and that's perfectly fine. They're not paying him as someone who needs to be a closer for them.
Seth, we heard Mark Stein tweet out that former Raptor or future Raptor, again, we don't know, Marc Gasol was a target of the Lakers. Do you think that Montrezl Harrell signing means no chance Marc Gasol goes to Los Angeles now?
I think they're running out of kind of avenues to add players. I think the only way we have to, you know, crunch numbers, but I think the only way they could really add Gasol is if he was willing to take the minimum, and I doubt that Mark is at that point in his career where he's got a ring, so I don't think he needs to be taking minimums to chase another one.
Yeah, I think I'm probably with you. I'm really going to be curious to see what his market looks like. I got to ask you about the Pistons because, you know, it's been weird. They signed Jahlil Okafor, who I forgot about, to be honest. And, you know, they've prioritized, I guess, the front court. And then they just signed Jeremy Grant to a 3-year deal for $60 million. Christian Wood appears to be on the way out. Is Grant for Wood, is that a good swap? Or I guess, what do you make of everything that Detroit's done so far?
That deal is just coming out, and figuring out the mechanics of how Detroit is actually doing all this is going to take some unpacking. So I'm not exactly sure. I think the expression we use is that's a whole lot of Jeremy Grant's that they just got at the $20 million per year. I think Jeremy Grant's a better player than Christian Wood. But that's, you know, that on top of drafting and trading for and signing several centers it's a curious look in Detroit right now.
Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet radio network. How tough is it for teams like the Pistons? We see the Hawks are trying to make some moves that they're at the lower end of the Eastern Conference, trying to make some sort of splash to show to their fans that they're serious about winning. But how far away are these teams for potentially being, you know, in the mix to at least be a playoff team, in your opinion, after some of these moves?
Again, we kind of have to see what shakes out with Detroit's team. I think the Hawks possibly have a clearer path to the playoffs. I think I don't love the dollar amount of the Gallinari deal, but I think for next year, that's going to be a very interesting offensive team, and that might be enough to sneak in one of the last couple spots in the Eastern Conference. So I think that they're probably going into the season with expectations of making the playoffs. I don't think Detroit is, and I don't think they're operating as if that's a priority anymore. They've kind of been a team that's chased the 8th seed for a number of years. And I think with new kind of management in place, that they're maybe hoping to step back a little bit and think a little bit longer term.
There's been obviously a ton of moves in the last little while, and this one might get lost in the shuffle a little bit. But I call me crazy, but I think my favorite move so far of the night is Derek Favors going back to Utah. 3 years, like approaching $30 million, about the mid-level exception. That team needed, you know, kind of toughness, front court depth behind Gobert in the second unit. He obviously played the most of his career there. I love that move for them, and that is the kind of move I think that, you know, makes me feel really good about their chances to be a team that can put some pressure on the Lakers and the Clippers in the West.
Yeah, I think that I like that deal too. I think Favors is much better than, you know, most of the
it's a pretty flooded market for centers, but I think most of the guys out there, Favors is better than on both ends of the court. And I think, as you noted, kind of their ability to stay solid defensively with Gobert out of the game had been a problem for them in the playoffs. So I think that that shores up that need for them. And you know, at the mid level, there's not a lot of wing play out there at the mid level. So they chose to prioritize kind of the backup big spot instead.
Yeah, I really like that fit, especially, I guess, like, if I'm teams in the West, are you looking at it now as, well, we have to find ways to slow down the Lakers, because at least for the next year, probably couple of years, it's going to be the Lakers, and that means getting big, mobile, you know, I guess, multiple options to throw at AD, and you think that that might be how those kinds of contender-type teams in the West might approach some of their spending, at least this offseason, maybe into the season?
I think so. I mean, I think the team that, especially if Jeremy Grant is leaving, I think that's – I'm looking at Denver for how they're going to handle that, because I think they're a team that probably thinks that they're right there. They should be competing. And as you noted, like, having kind of the larger – defenders who can match up on Anthony Davis, especially, is, I mean, there's not a lot of players who match up with him well, but at least aren't egregiously terrible matchups for him. And that's something that they're probably going to want to address.
Seth, what have you made the moves the Blazers have made via a couple trades? They got Robert Covington. They're getting Enes Kanter in a three-way deal. Are the Blazers, when healthy, could that be a team that can challenge the big boys in the Western Conference?
I think Covington was a great pickup for them. I think he's an excellent role player. Can play both forward positions a little bit. He's an interesting defensive player. He's not a traditional stopper in terms of guarding the other team's best player, but as a kind of a team and help defender, he's extremely disruptive, and, you know, gets his hands on a lot of balls and really helps the team's defense that way, and is a good and willing 3-point shooter. The Kanter deal is a little bit whatever. I would imagine he's going to just get, you know, spot backup minutes, assuming Nurkic is healthy, and then when Zach Collins you know, comes back to the fold. But he's a useful scorer against backup units. I think he probably helps them more than Hassan Whiteside did. So sure, and then they also. They kind of gave Rodney Hood, who's coming back from an Achilles injury, they gave him basically a one-year make-good deal too. And that if he can get back at all, he adds a little bit more you know, shot creation on the wings.
I got to say, I know Joe Harris has blossomed into a really, really nice player and is one of the best three-point shooters in the league and has had a couple of nice years. But seeing him get almost $80 million over 4 years definitely surprised me. I guess, you know, what do you think of the value of that deal? And do you see him as a kind of a tailor-made fit alongside KD and Kyrie? And who knows, maybe soon enough, James Harden?
I'm actually not surprised by that number. I was thinking he was going to get around he got 475. I thought he was going to get around 470, so it's a little bit higher. But he's one of the elite shooters in the league off movement. He's better putting the ball on the floor than he's given credit for. Really, really good at attacking closeouts, and, you know, is bigger than you think. He's got good size, which allows him to be somewhat defensively versatile. So I think, you know, for a team, however their team shakes out, whether they add Harden or not, that's a profile of player they need. So maybe they paid a little extra for kind of keeping that around, but it's they're in a situation where it's only money for them. There's not a lot of opportunity cost in terms of other things they could have done. So I have no problem with that, and I think they almost had to do that.
Seth, we know that Fred VanVleet is having a meeting with the Raptors tomorrow in Chicago with a couple of other teams. If he doesn't sign in Toronto, where do you think a good fit is for Fred VanVleet?
That's a tough one. So I think VanVleet is a player who is much better on a good team than he would be being the lead, you know, the first option on a lesser team. So while I think, you know, whatever the numbers have been batted around, if it's, you know, 20 million, a little higher than that, I think he's probably easily worth that for the Raptors. But if he were to go someplace like New York, it would be a little harder for him to actually justify that, because kind of some of his strengths maybe get hidden and his weaknesses more exposed if he is more of a focal point of opposing defenses. Whereas if he kind of shares the load with a player like Kyle Lowry, then you maximize his good qualities. So, you know, it's not my decision to make. And obviously if one team offers him a ton more money, like, you know, you wouldn't begrudge that. But I think from a pure basketball standpoint, I think he would be best served to stay in Toronto.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that conventional wisdom says that's what's going to end up happening, but I guess we'll see. He's taking some meetings tomorrow, so we'll see what happens there. You know, it sounds like Serge Ibaka's got a ton of suitors, and you can certainly see why. Runs up and down the floor, can still block shots, can space, can score in the paint as well. Do you think he's the type of player who will get more than the full mid-level on maybe a three-year deal, or do you think that that's kind of his sweet spot in terms of the market?
At this point, I'm wondering where that greater than mid-level money is out there still. You know, the Hawks have used a bunch of their money. The Knicks have a bunch of power forwards already, although that might not stop them. Would he be interested in going to Charlotte? So I think, yeah. I sort of feel like it's more his choice of contender at the mid-level or thereabouts would be my best guess.
Yeah, I don't see a scenario, and you're right. Like it seems like the cap room is kind of drying up here for some of these teams, and I guess like so the Clippers lose Harrell, and you know, they made the three-team deal on draft night, and they bring in Luke Kennard, which you know could be a nice move to kind of maybe stabilize their bench a little bit, give them some more alongside Lou Williams. But what else would you like to see them do to, I guess, really bring this roster together and, you know, help them, I guess, exercise those demons and be there come, you know, July when the Western Conference Finals come around?
I kind of think they could use a more traditional point guard. You know, Pat Beverly is a really good player, but he's more of a guy who plays off the ball on offense and then guards point guards. And then Lou Williams is a scoring guard who isn't necessarily running an offense so much as being the offense. And so I think maybe having something a little bit more traditional to, you know, get Paul George and Kawhi Leonard the ball in spots a little bit more is one thing. And then I think bringing back Jermichael Green might be a really important thing for them. I think with the center pairing of him and Ivica Zubac, would probably be an upgrade in terms of what they're getting out of that position than what they got from Zubac and Harrell in the playoffs. I think Jermichael Green is a underrated and very modern NBA ready big man.
Agreed.
With his ability at shooting.
Definitely.
Yeah. Seth Partnow, NBA analyst for The Athletic. Seth, thanks for this. Go enjoy the frenzy.
Yeah. I feel like I've missed about five deals while we've been talking, so I got to get caught up.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Seth.
There he goes. Seth Partnow from The Athletic on NBA free agency. Yeah, you just refreshed Twitter, and you're just waiting to see the news on Serge Ibaka. What is your gut telling you right now when it comes to Serge Ibaka, Josh? Is he staying or is he going?
I think he's gone. I think he ends up in Brooklyn. Kevin Durant's brother said it. I think he ends up in Brooklyn. Mid-level exception. I think that's where he ends up. Unfortunately, he's been a beloved Raptor, and obviously he's fit in beautifully here on the court and off the court. But yeah, I think he ends up in Brooklyn.
Now, are you like me that you want to see the soap opera that would be James Harden heading his way to Brooklyn? You just want to see how that's going to shake itself out?
Yeah, I want to see that happen for sure. The thing that stands out to me, and obviously, you know, now that Klay Thompson has torn his Achilles, that's obviously unfortunate. And pretty much you could have already argued once Durant left, the Warriors dynasty was more or less over, but now it really is. But Durant leaves, and, you know, he wants a new situation, leaves a great ready-made super team, and just goes to Brooklyn. I know he had the Achilles and he's coming and rehabbing, but he's trying to orchestrate another big three super team type of situation in Brooklyn. I don't really understand why makes Kevin Durant tick, I guess.
Right, because if he would have, even this season, Durant and Curry, they'd still be right there.
Oh, yeah.
As the favorites to win the NBA championship right near the top of the list, and you're right. But I just don't know how it would work. Ball-wise, there's guys who want to be ball dominant. And how do you tell Kyrie Irving that you're the third option on that team?
Well, and it's just like Harden doesn't love to play off the ball, and Kyrie can, and so can Durant. It's just, as the old adage, there is only one basketball, and it worked for Durant in Golden State the first year especially. He, you know, moved off the ball beautifully and fit in there, and then he got his looks in crunch time, and it worked perfectly. But that's with an established culture in Golden State, and they weren't going to put up with anything, and he knew what he was getting himself into. Now you're talking about, like, Kyrie and Enigma, Durant, Enigma, Harden, to a lesser extent, if he's there, Enigma. Steve Nash is the coach, D'Antoni is there, Amare's there. Like, they're figuring everything out on the fly and putting together all these new principles at both ends of the floor. It's a lot different than going into Golden State. They basically have to build this thing from scratch with championship expectations, with a rookie head coach who's never coached in any capacity of his career or his life, really. I don't see how it goes smoothly this year, but you never know. The NBA is unpredictable.
Yeah, it absolutely is unpredictable. What have you made of the Oklahoma City Thunder and their numerous, numerous first-round picks?
Rob and I talked about this the other night. It's great to stockpile all of these assets. Eventually, you got to hope that somebody turns into a franchise changer like Durant was, and obviously like Harden, Westbrook were years ago. But those teams, they made it to one finals, and then obviously, you know, injuries, trades, etc. Who knows the next time Oklahoma City is going to be in the conversation for even making the playoffs. It's great to have as many kicks at the can, as many lottery balls as you can, like the Sixers did. But eventually you have to turn those into tangible assets, and those tangible assets have to be good enough for you to win and contend for championships. Right. And maybe that ends up happening for Oklahoma City. But there's a lot of work to be done, and the draft is always a risky proposition. You know, it's great to have assets, but you have to actually turn them into something concrete and real.
Yeah, no question. We talked about it with Seth, and that's kind of the talk around here. We threw around some of those big name free agents. Donovan mentioned it early on in the program, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, potentially Giannis next summer. But honestly, Josh, like I can't go down that road again, that rabbit hole again, that the Raptors are going to sign a huge free agent, because we've never seen it. It's just, I don't trust American players to come here and play in Toronto. Allegedly, if the stories were right, Kawhi would have came if the Raptors would have just sold everything to bring his boy Paul George here with him. He would have eventually stayed here with the Raptors. I'm not sure if that's actually the case, but I'm just so skeptical when it comes to the Raptors signing a big-time free agent when we've really never seen an outside of Hedo Turkoglu. Like, we've never seen, and please don't give me the Chris Bosh was already here. He was a free agent. Yeah, he re-upped because he was already here. I'm talking prime, enormous, superstar free agents coming to Toronto. We haven't seen it yet. And I just can't buy into the fact and how terrific Masai Ujiri is and how the city is. I just can't buy the fact that an American free agent will come here.
It's fair. It's absolutely fair. I think that's a lot of maybe why Giannis was looked at as this realistic target, right? He's got the European background, he's Greek, obviously the African background, the connection with Masai, it all seemed like a tailor-made fit. A lot of these guys, it's not a cliche and it's not exaggerated. They don't like the cold. They do not like the cold. They like warm weather. They want to be in a warm weather market. New York, Chicago, Boston to a lesser extent, but certainly New York and Chicago, those are, you know, mainstay franchise cities, and even New York, free agents don't sign there, so I guess you can't really say that. No. But like Miami, Los Angeles, now the Texas teams, I feel like, even to an extent, are more serious contenders for free agents, because players just enjoy being in warm weather. We saw it with Kawhi. Paul George wanted to get the hell out of Indiana to Los Angeles, and then Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. I can't blame guys who want to be in sunny, sunshine weather year-round. The cold stinks. The weather stinks. But if the situation is great and you can sell somebody on that great situation and your supporting cast and all of your pieces and your future, then I do think that the infrastructure is different now for the Raptors, and I'm more on board with buying that a top-end free agent would come here. But yeah, until it happens, you have every right to doubt it.
Yeah, and I just don't know if it's good for the league that all these guys are building these super teams, right? Because we asked Seth about the Jeremy Grant signing, and that's great. The Pistons have Jeremy Grant. The Pistons are going to suck. Like, they sign a big free agent, a good player, but it's not going to really move the needle where the Detroit Pistons go moving forward. Gordon Hayward wants to go to the Pacers. That's great. Are the Pacers a team that potentially could contend for a world championship? No, it's just the have and have nots. And I'm all about player empowerment. I am. I think guys should make as much money as possible, because I never understood why fans side with the owners. Players are rich, but the guys who sign his check, they're wealthy. And yeah. I just never understood why fans side with owners. But I don't know if all this player empowerment is necessarily good for the NBA as a whole. Because if your team's in a smaller market, like, you just have no chance of winning ever. Like, when is the next time the Kings are going to be relevant? They didn't take a chance, Luka Doncic, a chance where they could have flipped their franchise forever, or at least the next, I don't know, 15 years have been super relevant. Instead, they don't draft him, and now they're just going to be one of those teams that be near the bottom of the Western Conference. I don't know if it's good for the league when guys like James Harden want to go play with their boys, Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. I just don't know if that's good for the league, Josh.
Yeah, like, I can see both sides of the equation, right? Like, on the one hand,
we love it because it's interesting, but is it good for a fan in half of the markets in the league?
No. No. And I think that if we really have this, you know, tough conversation, you could potentially eliminate a bunch of the teams in the NBA and shorten the season and then just basically use it as a prep for the playoffs. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. I don't think that ever should happen. But that's the trajectory we're kind of going, where 2/3 of the teams are basically irrelevant. And you could argue 25 of the 30 teams are irrelevant. How many teams actually have a chance to win the championship this year?
Right.
You know, you look in the West, it's the Clippers and it's the Lakers and, you know,
maybe
I guess
the Nuggets.
Maybe the Nuggets. And then in the East, it's Miami, Boston, Milwaukee, Philly.
Brooklyn,
Raptors,
maybe?
Yeah, Brooklyn. Yeah, okay. So the East is tougher. You're probably talking about 5 teams in the East and 3 in the West. So that's 8 of 30. Yeah, we're talking about 22 teams who have, at best, a puncher's chance.
And that's kind of why I like what Damian Lillard stands for, that he talks smack to a lot of guys who jump ship and join teams. He wants to stick it out in Portland and bring a championship to the Blazers. You have to admire that, because one of the best players in the NBA says, no, I don't want to build a super team. I want to do things right here in Portland. And I kind of like that, but yeah, it's tough because it's so interesting, but then there isn't a lot of drama, right? Like, it's not good. Like, the Pelicans have Zion Williamson. He's fantastic. But are the Pelicans, do guys want to go play with Zion in New Orleans? I just feel like Zion is just biding his time there until eventually he goes signs in somewhere else to go play with a couple buddies.
Yeah, that's fair. Like we saw what happened with
AD, Anthony
right?
Davis,
in New Orleans. Yeah,
right.
What happened to AD? He decided he didn't want it. You know, the pressure is just so great early on in these players' career to obviously be great, but also to put together a team around them that wants to that. I guess makes them want to stick around and they can be competitive and so on and so forth. And it's just to have no leeway basically from the draft until, you know, sign that first deal, you're probably getting like 6 or 7 years, which I guess is a lot. But at that point, then you're talking about, well, the clock is basically striking midnight here. And if we're not in a position to win a championship, I'm gone. And I guess that's it within your right, but you know, it's damn hard to win a championship, and there's so many jigsaw pieces that go into it, and you know, a good amount of luck, and sometimes you need that kind of trade of a disgruntled star to go your way to really bring everything together.
I know you can never say never, and I never thought, I'm sure you're the same way, I never thought we'd see an NBA championship here in Toronto. I really
no,
did.
Me neither.
I never thought this was happen. But do you envision a scenario one day where we see guys forming super teams for Toronto? I just don't see it. And I know you talked about the weather, but I just, if Kawhi Leonard, if he would have stayed with the Raptors, chances are they would have met the Lakers in the NBA Finals, Josh, and chances are probably would have beat them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fair. It's probably true, to be honest. Like, Miami, with injuries, took them to 6 games. You know, a healthy Raptors team, yeah, probably right. would have won the championship again. And, you know, Kawhi's wired a little bit differently, but that's the thing. Do we what's it going to take in terms of a young type of star free agent, you know, that type of transcendent level player, to look at Toronto and say, you know what, this situation also exists, this one also exists, but Toronto is the best fit for me, my family, and also on court. It's a lot. It's a lot to see. And yeah, I don't think it's out of line at all to wonder when, if rather, that's ever going to happen.
Would it take somebody like an RJ Barrett, who had an okay rookie season with the Knicks, but he turns into a superstar player and goes, I want to go play home. Hey, why don't you come with me? I think it would take
Jamal
something
Murray.
Like that. Yeah, maybe.
You know, Jamal Murray just signed his max in Denver last year, but he's like the Canadian thing is cliche, but you know, maybe
true.
Something appeals to Jamal Murray. If he is as good as he was in the playoffs, can you win with Jamal Murray as the best player on your team on a championship team? I don't think so, but I'm more open-minded to the conversation than I was before the playoffs. Like, he really opened
right.
my eyes and a lot of eyes. And if you can look at him as somebody that you can kind of build around, I think Jamal Murray's the type of player that other guys are going to want to play with. And if you can look at him as somebody, you know, that's part of the mix, then I think we can really start to have a conversation.
And again, I don't want to be too cynical when it comes to the Toronto Raptors, because as long as they keep that management structure intact, and with each passing day, you're like, what is the holdup here? I know Masai wants to take care of his boys first, but with what Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster, you definitely have to trust the process. They have that banner in 2019 that hangs forever, that they can get it done. And being a competitive team that can strike when the iron is hot to potentially get in there to be one of the elite teams, I think that's just the reality of being a basketball fan in this country. You hope, at least for the foreseeable future, I think, is you want the team to be competitive, and you just hope when they take their chance that they can eventually hit a home run. Because I just don't see a day where guys like Durant and Irving and James Harden are saying, yeah, let's team up with the Raptors. I just don't see a day where we'll see that with American-born players. But who knows? I hope I eat crow. I hope it's delicious. Because next year, if Giannis ends up signing with the Raptors, that would just flip the script. And maybe guys would be like, yeah, you know what? I want to go play in Toronto with Giannis because I hear it's a great city. It's a great organization. Masai Ujiri is a terrific guy. I want to go do that. But again, I'm not getting my hopes up because I'm not getting fished in, because I got hurt last summer with Kawhi Leonard. It hurt bad, Josh, because he broke up with all of us after we all thought that spring fling was going to last all semester. But it didn't. He went back home and broke our hearts before he did it.
That's how it works, right? When you're scorned, you get your guard up. And you know, the Raptors, I guess Van Vliet, if he left, people would be very scorned and upset, and maybe to a lesser extent Serge. But like, I expect Van Vliet to be back. And I'm honestly very fascinated to see, A, what the Raptors look like roster-wise, and just, B, how it's all going to go. Like, how do we factor in playing in Tampa and just everything that entails? Like, if it's a 72-game season, you know, what would be a good season for them? Like, if they won 45 games, go 45-27, would that be a good season? I feel like that would probably be pretty solid.
Yeah, but again, it just, I hate the inevitability of the NBA season when you're a middling team. That, yeah, get into the playoffs, that's great, but you know it's coming, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
and I don't think that's
what I think happens to the Raptors this year. I think that's the situation they find themselves in,
which ultimately will be a blessing come next year's free agency. All right, straight ahead, the producer of the program is Show Ali. He'll join us for an edition of Best in Show. We'll do that next. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. 20 minutes to go in the program. Me, George Russick, Josh Goldberg, joined right now by the producer of the show who crafted a fantastic 3.5 hours for you this evening, Show Ali, for another edition of Best in Show. Show, do you ever have faith that the Raptors will sign a big-time free agent in your lifetime?
Ooh, in my lifetime? Yeah, you know what? I think I do. As long as Masai Ujiri is there. Can that be the caveat?
Yes. Sure.
Yeah, I think. I think more than anything else right now, that the fact that Masai doesn't have a long-term contract is what worries me, I think.
Yeah, I think it worries a lot of people. But I think apparently he likes to take care of his people first and then worry about him. Let's just hope ultimately he gets a deal done. All right, what do you got for us tonight?
So as you might predict, we're gonna stick at least for now with NBA free agency, and this is a topic you guys touched on a little bit with Seth. We saw tonight that Davis Bertans got 5-year, $80 million, which works out to be $16 million AAV. Joe Harris is getting, as you guys mentioned, 4 years, $75 million, so slightly over $18 million AAV. Do you think that those two deals, and there are others out there that I didn't mention, but do those two deals raise the floor for whatever Fred VanVleet might get from the Raptors? Maybe if that deal gets worked out tomorrow. Look, we kind of figured he'd be getting around 19 to 20 mil, but do you think that has raised now, perhaps?
Probably, but I think Fred VanVleet already ultimately had a number in mind, and again, he's a guy that Donovan Bennett brought it up earlier. It's the bet on yourself, right? And he's making no excuses that he wants to get paid, and he deserves to get paid. The guy was a critical part of that championship team, and he's at that point of his career where he wants to cash in. And if Fred VanVleet ultimately left to cash in somewhere else, I don't think anybody would really blame him. He's at that point where he's got a family, he's got to take care of it. And please don't tweet me or text me saying, well, is $18 million not enough? Please. It's all relative when it comes to the NBA. If you have an opportunity to make $26 million or $18 million, you're going to make $26 million. That's just the reality of the situation. I think Fred VanVleet's going to get paid, and I just hope it's with the Raptors.
I'm curious if he's going to get 4 years or 5 years. I don't know if I'm in on 5 years. 4 years for sure, but I wonder, like, Bertans gets five. You know, you can go to that fifth year with the team that's signing him. Anything more than 20 or so million is probably the ceiling. Like, if you tell me tomorrow Van Vliet signs 4 years about $80 million, yeah, that's a perfect deal, and I think he'll deliver a lot of value, and I honestly expect that that's what is going to end up happening.
For the other kind of free agent we were talking a lot about tonight, Serge Ibaka certainly, and Eric Kareen, NBA writer for The Athletic, Raptors beat writer for The Athletic as well, my former journalism instructor, actually, a one-time journalism instructor.
Wow.
He tweeted out
fun fact.
There you go, yeah. Teams, he tweeted, that might have the mid-level exception space for Surge. Right this second, without any other moves, are Denver, Miami, Milwaukee, New Orleans, and Phoenix. And you guys already talked about Brooklyn as well. But of those five teams, so again, Denver, Miami, Milwaukee, New Orleans, and Phoenix, if he doesn't return to Toronto, which obviously the three of us would prefer, but if he doesn't, of those five teams, which team do you think you would prefer to see him thrive on?
That's George, what do you think?
You know what? Doesn't it feel like Serge Ibaka would fit right into that Miami Heat way of doing business? Because Jimmy Butler's a guy who went in there, changed the culture. Bam Adebayo is a emerging superstar in this league. And Serge Ibaka is that type of player. He plays hard. He runs hard on the defensive end, shoots some threes. I think Serge Ibaka would fit like a glove with the Miami Heat.
Yeah, Miami, I do agree. He'd be bring a lot to the table there. But I Brooklyn, it's a perfect fit. I think that's where he ends up, and I think it's a perfect fit because they could use what he brings at both ends of the floor. He's obviously got the relationship with KD. You know, the floor spacing is good. He can allow you to, I guess, be flexible defensively, right? He can play five. Durant plays the four. I just feel like it's almost too perfect of a fit, and they, I guess, can go to the mid-level and get it done. And I think that's what's going to end up happening. And he's in New York and a vibing metropolis for everything he wants to do off the floor. I think that's what ends up happening.
It would be great to see whatever Surge's, like, art, you know, quote unquote art videos, fashion videos would be if he did end up in New York. Out of curiosity, actually, and you know what, Josh, we'll start with you. Where does Serge Ibaka fall on your list of all time Raptors? Like, is he in the top 10? Is he in the 11 to 15 range? 16 to 20? Is he out of the top 20? Like, where does he fall? We'll start with Josh.
He's inside the top 20. I feel like he's probably in that like 15 or so range. You know, winning the championship definitely changes the perspective. Like, had they not won that title and he hadn't had many good moments, like he was really good in Game 7 against Philly. He had good moments in virtually every series, especially in the finals. In Oakland, he had some good games. If he doesn't do that, he's probably not in the top 20. But there you go. Championship changes the perspective, and big moments on the way to a championship obviously has an impact. So I think he gets in that like 15, 16 range.
I think he's got to be top 15. No, and a lot of the guys on that roster are already just automatically based on that championship got to be right there, right? Because how many other of the big guys? Obviously, there's Carter, there's Bosch, Stoudemire was the big player early on here with the Raptors. But just as an impact on the team, I just don't know how you don't put him in that top 15 range. He's right around that number 15, and a lot of those guys on that roster just simply based on the fact that they delivered a championship for Toronto, they got to be considered the top 15 guys on the team because, unfortunately, the list isn't that long with greatest Raptors ever.
So then, George, are guys like Ibaka and Van Vliet above guys like, in your opinion, Carter and Stoudemire?
Not above Carter. Stoudemire's different, right? Because he was the first big star of the Toronto Raptors, although he stabbed them in the back and wanted to get the hell out of here as quickly as possible. But, yeah, like, Carter's there, but I think Ibaka's right there. Like, who do you put above Ibaka, greatest Raptor? DeMar's clearly there. Yeah. Bosch is obviously there. And then the list gets thin, does it not?
Yeah, it's just like, how do you put guys like Mo Pete and Alvin Williams in the conversation?
Right. Two great Raptors. Ibaka's had a bigger impact on the franchise.
Yeah, they won. Winning the title. You're right.
That's
winning
what I mean.
Winning the title, like, changes the perspective, for sure.
Okay, so let's, and I know this is great radio, but again, it's November. There's not much going on. Let's do the list. Let's do it right now, the list.
Okay,
greatest Raptors. Kyle. Okay. Boom. DeMar, you gotta put Kawhi on that list, right?
Yep.
One season, but MVP, delivered the championship. Bosch, Carter.
Bosch, yeah.
Stoudemire on that list?
Yeah. Antonio Davis.
Okay. For sure. All
right. Alvin, Mo Pete are also in the mix there, I would say. Jose Calderon.
Yeah, Jose. Tracy McGrady?
Not as high. JV?
JV over Ibaka?
It's tough, right? Like, is Siakam? Siakam probably deserves to be out of Ibaka. Yeah, he does.
So we're
already
12.
Made an All-Star game.
Okay, so Siakam makes 13. I think Ibaka's ahead of Mo Pete and Alvin Williams.
Wow. All right.
What do you think? You think Antonio Davis is ahead of Serge Ibaka?
Yeah, I do. I just feel like, I don't know, Serge, outside of that, I guess how much do you put at, like, I guess the championship elevates him, obviously, a lot. But, like, outside of the championship, like, how many moments are there for Serge? He was good this year, but up until the championship run, I would say he was a bit of a disappointment. There was a lot of expectation when they brought him over from Orlando and they got bounced a couple of times.
Yeah, but he was fantastic this year too, right?
He was very good this year and he was really good in the championship run. And like, he's
probably... Is Fred above Ibaka?
Yeah, because of the Game 6 performance against
okay,
the Warriors.
Fred is ahead of Alvin and Mopi for sure. And JV.
Yeah, like I'm putting...
It's tough, right?
I'm putting...
It's tough when your franchise have been so inept for so many years that you have a soft spot for a lot of these guys. But Ibaka and Freddie V delivered in the biggest moments of the franchise's history.
They did. There's no doubt. It's hard to argue that. I guess I'm just looking at the body of work. You know, Alvin, you know, the toughness, the grit, right, playing through injury, big shot against the Knicks to help win the first playoff series. And, like, Mo Pete was just so reliable for so many years. And, you know, you're kind of a victim of circumstance. I guess what I'm saying is, like, Serge was kind of along for the ride of that championship. I guess you got to factor that in. But he wasn't really, like, a huge distinguishing feature of that team. Like, he came up big in moments, but he wasn't, you know, one of the go-to guys on that championship team. He had his
Here's an idea for another show. We'll get JD Bunkus on, we'll get Donovan Bennett on, we'll have a round table and write out the 20 greatest Raptors.
If we can line that up
and I do a show together.
Okay, there you go. We might have sports to talk about.
If we do. And even if we do, we can squeeze it in, especially during a four-hour program. All right, what else you got for a show? Sorry, I just hijacked your show, Best in Show segment. Sorry, my bad.
No, not at all. I like that kind of stuff. Actually, real quick, George, just because you're known to have strong opinions on this, I'm curious to see if this is cooled at all. Where are you on retiring Vince Carter's jersey?
Never. Don't retire that traitor's number. Okay, I'm tired of this. Oh, Vince had all this. No, he wanted to leave, and the way he left, he was a child. He gave away plays. I'm not going to dunk. I want out of here as quickly as possible. Sometimes bad breakups are bad breakups. You wouldn't put your ex's picture in your apartment after a bad breakup because, you know what, we had some good times together. Yeah, we did have some good times together, but the way you left was not good. Yeah, Vince Carter was great. He was one of the pillars of the franchise. I'm still not retiring that guy's jersey. Flair to the other team. You just can't disrespect the franchise like he did and get away with it and be honored with your jersey in the rafters of Scotiabank Arena. And I get it. People are like, move on. Time heals all wounds. Well, maybe it shouldn't sometimes. Maybe they shouldn't honor that guy just with the way he left. Just look at all the stuff he did to the franchise, and now you want to honor that guy? No, Kyle Lowry's number should be retired first, then DeMar DeRozan. End of discussion.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree 100% with everything you're saying there, George. You know, time makes you, I guess, heals all wounds. I guess that's fair. You don't always want to harbor a grudge, but you can let a grudge go without retiring a jersey, and I'm with you on it. I think it will end up happening, but you can't forget what a just dog he was at the end of his time here. It was terrible.
Yep. Could you imagine today in the era of social media that somebody would go to their college graduation to put themselves in front of the team to go to their call on the day of the biggest game in franchise history?
Yeah, they'd get crucified. It would be bad. Yeah. Like, it would be unrelentingly bad.
Yeah. I just don't get it. All right. One more show. We got to run.
Okay, we'll do a non-sports one.
Okay.
How about if, that, if you guys are cool with that? My roommate, he was playing this game on his Nintendo Switch in the living room before I came on with you guys, okay?
Okay.
And he was playing – the video game is called Ring Fit Adventure. And I guess it's a video game where you, like, use the motion controls to do workouts. And he sounded like he was – being put through torture, I guess. He sounded awful, frankly, even through the closed door. And I wanted to ask you guys, what is your least favorite thing that is actually good for you?
Least favorite thing that's actually good for me? Like, can it can be food?
Sure, anything you want, yeah.
Probably broccoli. Cliche as that is.
All right.
Interesting. Interesting.
Not mushrooms, Josh.
Yeah.
Mushrooms are sickening. So, are they good
for
you?
I like both of those things.
I guess they could be. Yeah.
Yeah, I like both of those things. I'm going to go to a workout thing. I can't stand doing the lat machine, the lat pull-downs. Oh, I know they're good for your back, and
Agreed.
The back stabilizes your whole body. I just can't stand doing lat pull downs. I don't know what it is about lat pull downs. The way you got to sit on the bench, the way you got to arc your back and get it down. And you can't use too much heavy weight because then you're doing the wrong form. I just can't stand lat pull downs. I know that's a very random thing to bring up, but it's the one thing that popped into my mind is that when I'm at the gym and it's time to do lat pull downs, I'm like, God, I hate these so much.
Yeah, that exercise is definitely would be atop the list, right? Like, it's good for you. And certain kinds of exercise, like running, you know, it's good for you. But, like, how many people really enjoy doing it?
Yeah, I'm not a big jogger. It's just a little boring for me just to continually run. Like, I like to run playing sports, but just to run? Not a huge fan. All right, we got to run because we just basically got to take a break and say goodbye. Show, great stuff tonight. Thanks for this, pal.
Good stuff, guys.
All right, one more break to go. Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. That's it for us. Josh, it was fun. I don't know when we're doing a show again together, but I would assume it'll be in the month of December.
Well, you never know, George. Lots of people take vacations and stuff, right? And you're usually filling in on other slots, so maybe. But my bet is sometime early in January.
Yeah, I'm the Derek Fisher of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You get a lot of looks, but ultimately, like, he's just not good enough to be a regular in the lineup. That's me. Like, it seems like he has a lot of talent, but ultimately, when you put him in a day-to-day lineup, you're like, ugh. No thanks. No Derek Fisher for me. Great job, Josh. Great job, Shoeli. Great job, Tom Young. Great job, Tom Young. CBS Sports Radio will watch you while you sleep.